This free program is paid for by the listeners of WBAI New York. If you're not already a member, think about joining us to help keep free speech alive.
Wow. So, good morning, Kamal. You stay tuned, and you'll hear some stuff you probably haven't heard before. I'm going to be talking to someone who you may recognize, who has a new nom de air. He is Dan Tapioca, and we'll be hearing from him. He's a dancer, and he is one of the incarnations of Marshall Efron, who you may remember has been appearing on Radio Unnameable as funny how quickly you forget. Oh, yes, Dwayne R. Duty, who was a kind of an archetypical Republican spirit of the New Frontier. And it is my sad duty to inform you that Dwayne R. Duty was hit by a truck and thrown under the bus, kicked to the curb, and finished with. So we won't be hearing from Dwayne R. Duty. We probably will hear from Marshall Efron this morning, as he tells a story about the time that he was Lenny Bruce's chauffeur. But the main attraction this morning, and he's shyly laughing as though to say he's not the main attraction, but he is a jazz singer, a musician that Lenny Bruce was fond enough of to use his music as his theme. And he's a filmmaker, an actor, and he's here this morning, Fred Baker. Good morning. And
hi, how you doing? Well, yeah, you got me, actor, singer, and filmmaker. That's right.
Yeah, well,
I like that. I like that you hit me right on the nose.
Yeah, and you're also a kind of an anonymous filmmaker. Your name is not in
currency.
In a particular film that some people think is maybe the best film that was ever made, The Battle of Algiers.
Well, I agree. Battle of Algiers is probably one of the more astounding pieces of work Costa Gavras ever done in terms of budget prop filmmaking, whatever you want to call it. I thought it was a documentary when I first saw it. It was that good, and it wasn't. Not a moment of it is really documentary. It's all staged. It's a beautiful, fabulous piece of work. Mm-hmm. Anybody who hasn't seen it should see it. But
and you had something to do with the Night of the Dead?
Oh, Dawn of the Dead.
Dawn of
the
Dead.
Yeah, I acted in Dawn of the Dead. I played Sergeant Rodriguez. And I said something to the effect of, okay, boys, go get those zombies, or something to that effect. which gets me a tremendous, tremendous currency in terms of all the freaks that love that film. I mean, I'm seen, I have people who've walked up to me, oh my God, you're Sergeant Rodriguez. And I mean, I think I spent one wintry night in Pittsburgh with George Romero, cursing him for making us work in our shirt sleeves at Pittsburghian chilly wind of about 10 degrees. And and not having a place for us to warm up. But we made this outdoor scene, and I got in it, and Dawn of the Dead is one of my calling cards in the cult world.
Yeah. And you acted with one of my favorite actors, Bert Lahr.
Oh, yes, in Hotel Paradiso on Broadway. Yeah, I've had a long sort of bubbly career, opened up as a young actor on Broadway for a play directed by Catherine Cornell's husband, Guthrie McClintock. It was called Bernadine, and I was, I think, probably around 16, 17 when I started on Broadway, right from Lafayette High School, Brooklyn. And then got drafted out of that because of the Korean War. And when I got back, I went back to Broadway and did an awful lot of work on Broadway in probably 12 shows that took me through a certain period as an actor, as a stage manager, and then as director as well. So I made that development in theater. And didn't even think of film until I realized I had a family to raise. By that point, I met Barbara, who's no longer with us. She died in 83, gone, a long time ago. So my wife had to go into other things, so went into Channel 13 and got a job as a writer-producer and did a show called Wednesday Review, which... was a pretty interesting show on Channel 13 in the, I'd say, late 60s. Yeah, so that brought me into filmmaking and documentary interviews, and I had to do an awful lot of stuff with a camera, with a Bolex or with an IMO that they had back there in Channel 13. And I just basically then moved right over into filmmaking from acting and directing in theater.
Would it be fair to say that you had a reputation for making difficult films?
I'd say politically, my head trip was always to the outsider. So the person who was testing the cliff of ideas, language, sexuality, drugs, those issues were being raised very early in my head as being very astoundingly provocative issues in our society as to how you dealt with leftist politics, how you dealt with the social phenomena of drugs and sex becoming quite apparent in the arts, in at least in film, which there before was not. I mean, everybody was under wraps, and so I broke out in that period early to mid 60s, and essentially. I think I've always been attracted to the outsider, and thereby Lenny Bruce. My best known film is Lenny Bruce Without Tears, and
that's not including your most recent film, which I would say
is an outsider, very outside. Asada Shakur, yeah. That's my most recent film. So it's a long span because Lenny Bruce was made in the early 70s. And Asada is now made in 2007. But I knew Asada then. I had met Asada. I thought, was a phenomenal young woman. I met her through Kunstler, through the lawyer Kunstler, who I play in my movie. I act Kunstler, and I think he deserves me as an actor to play him because I love the man. I thought he was a great man.
Joanne Chesimard was driving with some friends of hers, and she was stopped on the New Jersey Turnpike.
Yeah, and basically a police shootout occurred, they call it a shootout. I don't think it was a shootout. I think it was part and parcel of, as in my film, I depict the murder of Fred Hampton, part and parcel of the murder of some probably 41 Black Panthers by police who were gunning for them as a result of the COINTELPRO program of J. Edgar Hoover. It is just simple as that. I mean, it wasn't even in the Sean Bell Amadou Diallo class. This was real. What they're thinking now, Dick Cheney was trying to do in our current time, which is starting to emerge in the news today about assassination squads. These were assassination squads. And Assata Shakur was in a car with Zaid Shakur and Zaid Malik Shakur, who was one of the high officers of the Black Panther Party, of the movement of Black Panther Party on the East Coast, and with Sundiata Okoli, another Black Panther, in pretty high up in the echelons of the Black Panther Party leadership. And she was an inspiration. She was a young college girl who was...
What year was that?
This was 1972. And she, her rise to popularity in the Black Panther Party had to do with a kind of fervor she immediately called onto herself, was able to call onto herself, and so she was great in recruiting. And we're not, I can't say that they were a target, but it just fell in line with how many people were targeted in the various cities around the country, how many officers were shot up by the police, how many Black Panther murders and maimings and injuries and arrests were being made in those days. So these, oh, God, I just turned my earphones way up inadvertently. So the car was stopped, and somehow or another, two people died, and two other people were wounded in a lot of police gunfire. And she was wounded twice in her shoulder and under her arm, and Malik Shakur was killed. Two bullets in his head. Sundiata Kohli, who was driving the car, was able to duck and escape into the woods. And someone caught some crossfire. One of the state troopers caught some crossfire and was killed as well. And she was arrested and charged with the murder. So was Sundiata Kohli when he was eventually flushed out of the woods. He was also charged with murder, not only of the state trooper, but of their fellow Panther who caught police gunfire. And it was as far as anyone I've ever spoken to in my research on the film. I mean, it was just such a setup case. They took 4 years to bring it to trial. They had no direct evidence against her. She was wounded and couldn't raise her arms, and she had her arms in the air, and they tried every case they could all over the country that they had a woman, not even a Black woman, but wherever they had a woman in a seemingly SLA or Symbionese Liberation Army or whatever kind of action some radicals were taking by maybe robbing a bank or whatever, they extradited her and charged her as being that woman, and it wasn't even the same pictures. So they were
who was the attorney general?
Her attorney was her aunt.
The attorney general at this time.
The attorney general at the time, actually, I'm not sure I remember, but
was it Mitchell? Meese?
Was it who?
Mitchell and Meese.
No. It was before them. It was during Nixon. So that who?
No, Mitchell. Well, Mitchell
was, so it was Mitchell. Yeah, yeah, it was Mitchell. But it was Hoover. Mm-hmm. It was J. Edgar Hoover. It was a an absolute vendetta. When they raised the arms, when the Black Panthers said, we have a right to bear arms and we have a right to defend ourselves and our community from police brutality and from being oppressed, and we're not threatening anyone, we're just saying that we have a right to defend ourselves, that was it for J. Edgar Hoover. I mean, that image of a militant black dissident organization was set up for the most treacherous murders, shootouts, and police brutality known, I think, in the history of anything that this government has gone against, that our government has gone against within its borders. I mean, way, way beyond anything.
Well, they said some pretty dangerous things, like power to the people.
Yeah, that's dangerous. Mm. I don't know.
Like, everyone should have breakfast?
Yeah, kids should have breakfast. Kids should be able to go to school on it. Yeah.
Dangerous stuff.
Yeah. And so I, at the same time, I was involved in activist, I guess, being a filmmaker. I was carrying a camera and going to demonstrations, went to the Pentagon, covered everything Abby and Jerry did, except for the 68 convention in Chicago. I didn't go. And I got in some trouble, and I met her in the system as she was going through the system, and she impressed me tremendously. She was just a beautiful, beautiful person and woman who was caught up in something. She had no idea that it would go as hard as it went against her, with a life sentence, to serve a life sentence in the state of New Jersey without the possibility of parole. And miraculously, within 3 years of beginning to serve that sentence, she was lifted out of jail. She escaped the system and fled, eventually to emerge in Cuba, where she is today. She's under exile in Cuba today. And that's what my film is about. All of those aspects, the shootout, the trial, the incarceration, the escape, and the aftermath. And it's a tough form. I've also reason one of my, you say, I'm sort of a fringe, is that I've always tried basically experimental forms in film. I've always felt it was more like jazz, and that you had to basically work with it in another way, or because it as a, you know, if you studied too hard what was done before, that somehow the creative aspects were possibly more difficult to master than it was if you just let yourself go and do so. This film is an attempt to really mix the two forms, which is live-action drama, because I set it in a contemporary love story between a filmmaker who is essentially my
alter ego
in the film, and a beautiful young black journalist who's studying her at Columbia University. She's studying journalism. And so they meet at a kind of a music festival, which I had been hired to shoot, the Duke Ellington Music Festival. And so I basically put them back in that festival. I had all the footage. Charlie Persip, the great drummer, is in my film. All these great jazz guys are playing in this festival, and they meet and immediately are attracted and fall in love. So there's a bit of a sexy love story in the film. And then they both find out that they're both doing the same research on the story of Assata Shakur. It's kind of a trick setup. But then it takes a road right into documentary filmmaking. And is as much as I could of materials I could find, it's basically a pure documentary. Like Lenny Bruce is a pure documentary. There's no reenactments. It's just Lenny. And it's just the narrative.
And witnesses.
Yeah, it's a witness to the reality of what Lenny Bruce did, his performances, et cetera, et cetera. But in the case of Asada Shakur, I really created a dramatic format for it, and it could be ripped apart by the purists who believe that the reenactments and trying to mix the two. But at the same time, there's a lot of that in Algiers. You mentioned Algiers.
Right.
There's a lot of that intention in Costa Gavras in that era. To find documentary, newsworthy documentary material, and to research it. In his case, totally recreated it so well that you think it's what's actually going on. Some of those movements of the people in the demonstrations, there's no way that you could tell that they were all enacted by actors and extras and all that. So that's a work of genius to take it to that level.
Godard did similar things.
Yeah, I think Jean-Luc did beautiful things in that direction, albeit on a much smaller scale.
I mean, it's like taking the diction of the best of news photography and putting it with the best of dramatic theater.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And there's such theater in news photography. I'm glad you brought that. You said that, news photography, because that's essentially the sort of the mashed potatoes of documentary filmmaking. I mean, there's no way you're not going to get to headlines and photographs from newspapers and historical documents that you can get at libraries and things like that. They're very, very hard in some cases to find footage. And in the case of Asada Shakur, there was like next to nothing in terms of footage of her. What footage I did get is in there. But so you essentially go as a building blocks to the newsprint and news photos. And I love them. I mean, I love seeing them.
Well, you know, there is like a problem that filmmakers have when they're trying to recreate the emotions of a particular time when there was a lot of repression. You know, I had something to do with a movie called Chicago 10, where there was a certain amount of news footage, quite a bit, as a matter of fact, because of an accident where the networks weren't able to cover it live because of an electrical strike. So there were literally hundreds and hundreds of 16-millimeter cameras in the streets, but the film crews were filming with the 16-millimeter cameras. And so there was a lot of that kind of footage, but of course there was nothing from the courtroom, where the counter drama is taking place. So that was created in the form of an animated cartoon, and it conveys the moment, and
it's interesting. It's also a news form, animated mm-hmm. cartoons, or even just.
Right.
Cartoon drawings when photographers are not allowed in, but artists are, to capture the spirit of a cross-examination, and they used to do excellent depictions of how the witness looked in almost like joke book drawings, I do a little bit of animation in Asada. In terms of her wounds, I wanted to do some special effects as to what happened and why the doctors say that she could not never have even moved her arms to raise a gun to shoot this policeman who was caught in crossfire. And so I use animation. I mean, it's considered animation, but it's actually medical drawings of moving figures and bullets going in. We actually see the bullet go in slowly and break clavicle bones and stuff of that nature. So it's I love all those forms. And this film has is very rich, this film, you know, whether it finds its way into the difficult marketplace is another story. And that's starting to happen. I won the just recently won the best feature in the Harlem Film Festival, the Harlem International Film Festival. And I've also been selected by the New Filmmakers, and we're going to screen the film for the public and for critics on at the Anthology Film Archives down on 2nd Avenue.
When will that be?
That's on April 2nd at 8 p.m. And that's our second New York screening. And from what I gather, Variety will be there, and a few of the press are coming in to review the film. So that's a leg up.
Is it going to be like a single night, or will it be?
Yeah, a single night at the Anthology. It's part of a series called the New Filmmakers series. Mm. Not that I'm a new filmmaker; I've been making films since 1963. So, but I mean, it's that's the organization called the New Filmmakers, and they've chosen the film for a special night. Such as other films have their special night, you know. Right now, the Anthology's playing an interesting series, and I'm going Sunday to see a film called Coming Apart by Milton Moses Ginsberg with Rip Torn. They're doing a Rip Torn series. And the only reason I'm plugging that is, and that I'm going there is because Coming Apart and my first film, my first feature, Events, both came out in the same year, 72. And so they were sort of side by side, not, I wouldn't say competitive, but in those days, if you made a film like Coming Apart with Sally Kirkland and Milton Moses Ginsberg, or my film Events with Frank Cavastani and Joy Bang and some excellent New York people, it was immediately taken up and heralded. In fact, the matter is, Grove Press saw our midnight screening of Events at Ben Barinholtz's Elgin Theater, if you remember the Elgin.
Certainly do.
And that was my idea about screening films at midnight, for especially if I could invite my Broadway friends,
right?
Because of all my experience in theater, so I'd post all the backstage and say one of yours, meaning stage manager, actor, director, such as I was on Broadway or with Broadway people, and or the theater crowd in New York, and said, really at midnight, you know, or you know, one of your own has made a film, and so I blocked traffic for one of the first midnight shows ever shown at the Elgin Theater in 69 or 70, and Barney Rossett couldn't get through traffic, and he said, "What's going on?" There was a screening of film, so he got out and bought a $3 ticket and went in to see the film and bought it the next day for Grove Press for an awful lot of money. After that,
was this the Lenny Bruce?
No, this was Events, a film called Events, film I made before I made Lenny Bruce, my first full length feature. Before that, it was jazz shorts. I made some jazz shorts with Gigi Grice and Martha Graham dancers, one called On the Sound, which won a lot of awards, and then made a whole bunch of little kind of kooky shorts. Snatches is one, and then I made Events, which I broke through and got a sale to Grove Press. Grove Press, at that time, was distributing a film called I Am Curious Yellow, which was a big, big hit. And they thought, unfortunately for them, and I guess fortunately for me, they thought Events could match that and gave me a lot of money for it. So it was one of those handheld 16-millimeter winners in the early independent market, Events.
Well, what was there about Events that...
Sex. It was about a filmmaker who, instead of driving a taxi and instead of working as a waiter to get by and raise his family, decides to go and make some porno on a Saturday night and enlists his friends to do so and accomplishes that.
Someone has just made a remake of that.
Yeah.
Do they credit you? Or?
No, they don't. No, I don't even think they've seen my film. I think it's just a very easy idea.
Jackie Onassis saw your film.
Right. Yeah. Well, Events was Events is also an interesting film. And someone, there's a guy named Mike Rosso who runs a thing called Popeye Cinema, who's bringing out a box set on me, and it'll be Events, Room Service 75, which I did with Tommy Ungerer, the great illustrator of his book Fornicon, and I did some highly erotic stuff to make money, which I love. So I have this guy that's now interested in bringing out a box set of White Trash, which was made in 92, Events, which was made in 70, Room Service 75, which was made in 74, 72, 73, 74. And I'm getting do you know the name Jerry Damiano, Deep Throat, and Devil and Miss Jones? Well, he has a box set coming out with this company. So I'm getting my box set. I'm going to be the sort of the intellectual Damiano,
Well, I don't think there's any comparison, really, between your films and his. His are, full of events, but not much character.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I kind of got off on some of his work. I thought.
America was having a really serious problem with sexual repression at that time.
Oh, yeah.
And your film, I guess, and I Am Curious, Blue and Yellow, and other films at that time.
Oh, yeah.
Like, broke those boundaries. Your films are going to be seen locally in April.
April 2nd.
And are any of them available as DVDs now?
Yeah, people can get almost anything I've made by just going to my website, which is filmsbyfredbaker.com. Just those three words, films with an S, byfredbaker.com. And they'll see my films. And you can then, there's a contact number, and if they're interested in buying them, I have them all on DVD. And Warner Brothers has some very interesting films I made in the mid-80s, called Jazz Masters 1 and 2, which was a compilation from something called Sound of Jazz, which a guy named Robert Herridge bequeathed to me in his somewhat alcoholic bed at the hospital. And he said I was the only one that he thought could handle these things properly. And he gave me the originals on a great, great jazz document that he did in 58 and 59 with the Omnibus, organization that was doing work for Channel 2. And they shot almost all of the giant, he shot almost all of the giant jazz players, the whole of the Count Basie band at that time, Billie Holiday, Roy Eldridge, John Coltrane, Miles Davis. I mean, just you name them, they're in this footage that I then got in videotape, and eventually in 92 made Jazz Masters 1 and 2, Volume 1, Volume 2, and Warner Brothers bought them. And then I also collaborated with Stan Getz's brother, Bobby, who was a lifelong friend, and actually introduced me to my wife, Barbara. This goes way, way back. And Bobby then was working for CBS and had the opportunity with a professional crew to go out and shoot his brother Stan's concerts for the Mondavi Winery out in California. So they're just these gorgeous Stan Getz, Victor Lewis on drums, and Jim McNeely on piano, and just some phenomenal music. And that, so I was sort of also bequeathed the end result of those shootings, of those concert shootings, and made two films called Vintage Gets, Vintage One, Vintage Gets Collection One and Two. And those films have been with Warner Brothers now since 1982. And they won't let them go. And all my other work comes basically from their licensing. Not their honest count, believe me. but every time they want to re-up the license, I make the price higher. And I'm able to then afford to shoot another movie. And that's every 5 or 7 years. You know.
You're not related to Chet Baker.
Not at all. But I'm a great, great fan. Phenomenal fan.
Do you have any film of him?
Only that documentary they made. I have it in my own private collection, but I didn't make any film of Chet, no. But he was such a sensitive, beautiful player. Do you remember a trumpeter in New York named Tony Fruscelli?
No.
Who was like a Chet, played even like lower notes and stuff, like very, very vibrant and low. Was a protege of Miles. He died very young. He died freezing to death in Central Park. There was so much overuse of hard drugs among that crowd, you know, that so many people died too early. Well, yeah, I love Chet Baker.
And were you friends with Lenny Bruce?
I was pretty tight with Lenny during the Go-Go bust. You know, that was the 64 situation in New York. One of my college buddies was Howard Solomon, who ran the, I forget the name of the club, God, the Go-Go. Yeah, Go-Go. Oh, Go-Go. And that's where he was busted. And that's where the famous time when Irwin Corey had to sub in for him. And he was taken away off the stage. And then convicted by Judge Murtaugh of obscenity in New York, which is totally ludicrous. And at that point, I got to know Lenny very well. And helped him with some of his paperwork. For the most part, he was very, very oppressed by lawyers who weren't doing what they wanted him to do, what he wanted them to do, and so he was basically trying to make his own case for himself and how to present his work to the courts that were pursuing him relentlessly. So he needed people like me. I helped him. I ran for him. I ran and did some. And he promised to be in a film of mine. I wrote a script about him. And then he went back to L.A. and...
He did make some films.
He made something called...
Terrible.
Motorcycle films, Leather Jackets. Or something.
Yeah.
Just awful. I have some of that in my film.
Oh, you do?
Yeah. But it just a couple of shots of it in my documentary on Lenny. That documentary has been... over the years, fairly important to me, the Lenny Bruce documentary, over the years. It's kind of stuck around. Seymour Wishman of First Run Features has it in America and Canada. So it's a film that I've consistently done well with.
There was a movie made about Lenny, and with all due respect,
I mean Dustin.
To Dustin Hoffman.
Piece of shit. Excuse me.
We mustn't say words like that.
Oh, I'm sorry.
On the People's Radio.
Yeah.
But it had nothing to do with the person that Lenny was.
Well, I'll tell you, I had a run-in with Dustin about that. Dustin called me when he got the part and said, I hear you made a documentary. Can I borrow print? So I sent him, as I said, it would be an honor. And I sent him a 16 millimeter print which I'm sure he watched to the sprocket holes, you know, to pot it. The sprocket holes came off. He watched it so much. Because there was so much Lenny in it. It was wall-to-wall Lenny. My film has nobody but Lenny in it, you know. And when my film was finished, when it was being premiered in L.A., I was friends with the comic Freddie Prinze. And Freddie Prinze was going out with Lenny's daughter. Kitty.
Kitty, right.
Kitty Bruce. And so I was invited to meet with them, with Freddie Prinze, Kitty Bruce, and Sally Marr at the comedy club. And I had my kid with me, Garen Baker, who listens to your program, by the way. I have to tell you, he's an avid listener. My son was an artist, a wonderful artist. And so he was, all of about 13 or 14 at the time. And we met at the comedy store, and Freddie went on and did his act, and sitting next to me is Dustin. So I turned to him at one point and said, "Do you think you can ever give me the print back?" And they hadn't shot the movie yet. So he said, "Why? It's not a very good film." I mean, that kind of head trip. I was wondering, well, where did that come from? And we're sitting in a pretty intimate circle of people. And Lenny's mother's there, and Lenny's daughter's there. You know? So I've always had a little bit of a... When I did go to see the film, of course I would hate it, because at that point, I had no... I sort of lost respect for his style of his human style, anyway.
Well, I like Dustin Hoffman as an
actor. I like that. He's phenomenal.
And as a person, I knew him a little bit, but it wasn't Lenny Bruce. It was Dustin... Hoffman as
Dustin Hoffman.
Kind of an angry...
It was Dustin Hoffman. Dustin Hoffman. Yeah. 586.7 times 29.35 is 56.28. He won an Academy Award for that. That was Rain Man. Yeah, Rain Man. But
hi, you're on the radio.
Oh, bless you. Bless you so much, it hurts.
Good morning to you, Marshall.
I'm fine. Thank you so much for inviting me into the morning.
Uh-huh.
Is this the Friday the 13th?
Is it really?
Is it Friday the 13th? Am I mistaken?
Is that a particular important day to you?
I don't know. Do you?
I don't.
Have you ever heard of someone saying something about Friday the 13th?
Yeah, it's supposed to be unlucky, isn't it?
Isn't that what people have said?
People have said that, yes.
And that they didn't trust things that happened on Friday the 13th?
Right. Fear of that flame retardant, Tris.
You know, no. It has to do with the number of apostles.
Phobia. Oh, really?
Sure, there were 12 apostles, and Jesus made 13.
Huh.
And they said, people say, 13 for dinner is unlucky.
13 for dinner?
Yeah, because someone will be dead within a year.
A lot of work.
Sure is, but who? I don't cook.
I do.
I order out.
And it's expensive for 13 to order out.
So you and I have an agreement about Dustin's... And I'm a friend of Dustin's. I like him. But I'll tell you something. He did a shitty job. Bad word. I'm sorry. He did a bad job in his Lenny Bruce. Because he characterized Lenny Bruce as a guy who was headed for suicide.
Yeah.
And Lenny Bruce was a fun-loving person. He was always looking for the fun in life. And he was a really exciting person to be with.
I absolutely agree with him.
And he made jokes. He joked all the time. I don't mean make jokes like he was loquacious and could turn a phrase. He could do that. But in addition to that, he saw the humor.
He not only that, he could make you pee in your pants.
Yes, and I would.
Yes, I did.
Me too. Let me show you my pants that I've saved.
Oh, okay.
The DNA is still there.
Yeah.
Would you be kind enough, Marshall, to tell the story about the time that Lenny called and woke you up?
No.
Yes.
I just want to say that I love being around him. I really enjoyed him very, very much, and I used to drive him around a lot.
Oh, really?
And the reason I would drive him around a lot is because we go to places and get high.
Yeah.
And he didn't want to lose his license. And the DUI, all that business, he just didn't want to be stuck with a situation, whereas I didn't care. I could drive and drive. I drove him around in a four-seater Morgan with a flat grill, a 1952 four-seater flat grill Morgan.
Wow.
In Los Angeles. That was my car.
Wow.
So it was great because, in a sense, the cops weren't looking for, they would love to bust him. Any way they could, they would love to bust him. But they weren't looking for these idiots driving around in an old sports car in Los Angeles. So it was like being so obvious and so out of the open.
Right.
They'd see the car, they wouldn't see him. We generally wore sunglasses in the daytime. And we'd drive to various people's, various friends, and then we'd sit around and partake of the drugs, which was great, just fabulous. And we'd have a real good time.
Was this near his demise?
No.
This was not?
No, this was, he died in 66.
66, yeah.
This would be 59, 60, 61.
Right.
Around the time that he was at the body shop.
Ah. Oh, that's a lot earlier. Because I was going to ask about a comedian. Oh, God, I wish I remember her name. Maury. That he was seeing sort of later on. Near the time, I can't remember her name now. Eisenstock, something. Lotus Weinstock.
Lotus Weinstock.
Was originally Maury, something Maury. So that was not her. She came by that name after her love affair with Lenny.
She was great.
I interviewed her and then got to be very good, close friends with her. And she did a funny thing on him answering the phone. In a Jewish accent, talking to people that would call him up. You don't need a dentist. I have dentures. I've been in the show business, and I don't need the dentures. I can eat an apple. Yeah.
He was so good. Big blonde. A nice, great big blonde.
Yeah.
Good person. Really good person.
His humor was fat and luscious. As he was great, and because it was so full of phenomenal mimicry, which was the greatest tool a comic could have, vocal and also character mimicry.
He'd do playlets. He'd play all the parts.
He did his Sabu in my movie. Well, it's not in my movie. It comes out of the Steve Allen show, where he did his Sabu with just the walk. This little. You could just see this little dark Indian kind of mincy 13-year-old, you know. He just captured the essence.
Yes. Well, he got all those guys. He would do the James Cagney movie.
Yeah.
He did the whole film.
Yeah, Father Flotsky.
That's exactly right. And
you don't have to speak like that, do you?
Rocky.
You're a fool.
I consider it a privilege that I had a chance to know him, and we drove all over the place.
Yeah, I was in a Broadway show, and went through Philly, and we were, and I had no idea that this would happen, but we all took a table at Rubens, Philly Rubens, yeah, and in comes Fat Jackie Leonard, Lenny Bruce, and I forget, two or three other comics. And they sat right next to us, and they went until 4 in the morning making people pee in their pants.
Yeah, and turning red in the face.
Yeah, just and absolutely, you couldn't stay in your seat. They were so funny, and they were just doing open repartee between each other.
That was nothing at all in this performance in Lenny. Lenny, what Lenny? This had nothing to do with the human being. That was the human being. That was the guy.
No.
So we just know that he was a very, very serious man who had nothing to do with humor except when he walked on stage and then would do killing humor. How did this happen?
Yeah.
That was to me, that was a great mystery movie.
I don't know. I walked out. You can imagine. I just spent 3 years putting together a film about someone I loved. And there was very little love in that movie. It was all angst, and I thought Dustin was just terrible in it.
No, he was very good. He was very good. He was wonderful, but it wasn't Lenny.
Oh, no. If you're not going to capture, you know.
It had nothing to do with Lenny. Yeah. Lenny Bruce was not that guy.
Well, that's what I mean. So what's the point?
I don't know. I have no idea.
You're going to call it Lenny, and it's going to be basically about, you know, the family geschichte and all the problems.
It's about a guy with problems. It was a guy about a really unhappy
instead of the comedy, instead of what he was doing
he was a crazy guy, and everyone knew it, and he was wonderful as a crazy guy. He was a perfect crazy person, and you had to adore him for being that. He was brave.
Yeah, very
courageous. What happened was when they finally arrested him too many times, then he didn't get funny, and he lost the humor because he was always about... the dirty words and the cops busting you and the freedom of speech and all that, and he'd have legal briefs.
Well, he was oppressed.
Yes.
Can you imagine trying to handle 15 to 20 cases that go from drug busts to obscenity? I mean, make the full gamut.
The cops would do his act in court.
Yeah.
Badly. That's not the way I'd say it.
Badly. That's the line.
They would read the transcript.
Yeah.
This reminds me of what Bertolt Brecht was called before the committee, the House Committee. Was it the Dyes Committee?
House on American Activity?
Yeah, House on American Committee. And they said, Mr. Brecht, did you write this song, Workers of the World? Something like, release the shackles that bind you, throw the shackles away, this, that, that. And he said, no. First thing, I didn't write in English, I wrote in German. And this was a bad translation.
right.
And they said, well, thank you, Mr. Brecht. So thank you, that's very illuminating. I wouldn't write such a thing with it. And then the next day he left. He kept his Swiss passport, his Swiss citizenship, and he went to East Berlin.
Yeah.
And Lenny was a truly a political victim at that time.
Oh, no doubt.
The society couldn't take him. No, it wasn't the society.
Well, I think
it was the authorities. Society could take him. They loved him.
Yeah, I think the prude, what can you say, society, the powers that be, the establishment,
it's always going to
need somebody that's going to poke the finger and say, you're full of shit.
You can't say that. You did a bad one. You can't say that.
With delay.
Because we have
Lenny is dangerous for us here.
Oh, okay.
This is so... I'm sorry.
I didn't know. I'm sorry.
So we could talk about other people's freedoms.
Take me away. Take me away in the paddy wagon.
But Marshall...
Yes, sir?
Don't you have a story that you...
I have a fabulous story. I have a fabulous Lenny Bruce story.
Lenny Bruce?
Yes,
I wish you'd tell it.
This is a rare story because... It's not in the biographies or anything. It was a wonderful thing that happened, and I was a very marginal participant. I was a bystander, but I loved it. This is a situation. I knew Lenny. We had a good time. We were driving around a lot, this, that, and the other. And then one Saturday night, it was a Saturday night, I got a phone call. It must have been 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, so between Saturday and Sunday. 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock, something like that. I was asleep. I got a phone call, and I reached across, and I got the phone, and I said, hello. And he said, what are you doing? I said, I'm sleeping. He said, you know who this is? I said, yeah, it's Lenny, I know it's you. He says, well, what are you doing? I'm sleeping. He said, no, you're not. Get up. And at 3:36, he gave me some odd time. 3:36, I want you to watch Rocket to Stardom. Do you know that show? I said, yeah, it's on Channel 9. Put on Rocket to Stardom. What are you going to do? What's happening? I can't talk to you. I got other phone calls to make. Click. He hung up. So I watched the movie on Channel 2 for a while, keeping track of the time on my watch. And then at the appropriate time, I switch over to Channel 9 where Rocket to Stardom. Rocket to Stardom was a talent show that began at midnight on Saturday, on the night of Saturday, and it went all the way to 9 o'clock in the morning on Sunday. It was on every week. And it was sponsored by the Yackel family of fine cars. Bob Yackel, the Lucky Dutchman. They had a Oldsmobile dealership, they had a Plymouth dealership, they had a Renault dealership, they had all kinds of these dealerships. Not Chrysler Plymouth, but Plymouth. And, or a DeSoto dealership, but, and they had dealerships all over the place in Southern California. So anyway, and Betty Yackel, who was not Bob Yackel's wife, but Phil Yackel's wife. Phil was Bob's brother. She was Phil Yackel's wife. She was hosting that night, and she came out in her gown, and she said, "Now, I'm going to introduce to you." They had a little boy playing to a record. He was conducting, a four-year-old child was conducting with a baton to a record. God knows, this is the worst talent show in the world. Luigi Vinastetti is going to sing Lady of Spain. And then I knew the guy who was on the accordion, Tony Visconti. And Tony was going, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And then out comes Lenny. Lenny's wearing a terrible tuxedo. He's got a grease paint mustache, and he's got his eyebrows with grease paint. And he comes out, and he goes, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Tony's going, da-da-da-da-da-da. And then he starts to sing, Lady of Spain, I adore you. Lady, and he starts singing Lady of Spain as Tony is vamping behind him. Da, 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 da. Suddenly, Lenny stops, and he looks at the camera, and then he starts to go into a quiver and a shake, and he starts to do this tremendous kind of violent vibrations all over him and struggling himself up and down. I see his sleeve goes up, and it smears his mustache up across his face, and his eyebrows go like that up his brow. And he then throws himself on the floor and is writhing around. And all the time, Tony is going, da-da-da-da-da, da-da-da-da-da. And then Betty Yackel runs in, and a couple stage guys run in to restrain Lenny, who's fighting them. And then he throws them off, and he continues the song right where he left off. And that was a great moment for me. I said, oh, you did it. You son of a bitch, you did it. It's a great, great, great moment. And everyone was looking at him. And that's my story.
Okay.
Well,
great.
That's a wonderful story. Wonderful story.
Da-da-da-da, da-da-da-da.
Yeah, that's what he did. That was the, that's the theme. That's the vamping theme from Lady of Spain. I'll never forget that.
Yeah.
Tony Visconti was a hairdresser.
Yeah. Where, and, was this, is this all Hollywood you're talking about?
Yeah. It's 1959 or 60.
Wow.
On Channel 9 in Los Angeles. Nobody, I mean, I don't know who saw it, because Lenny was trying to call as many people as he could to get them to watch
Channel
it.
Channel 9, was that KTLA TV?
No.
No?
It was KHJ-TV.
KHJ-TV.
KTLA was Channel 5.
Yeah. That's where I found the Lenny in the bathroom tied up police photographs. Somehow they had them, and I got them for the movie when I was doing my research.
When he died.
Yeah, when he overdosed. So there. And then everybody in and his mother have lifted those out of my film and used them some one way or the other. But, yeah.
It's like the natural document. I saw him about 3 weeks before he died. He looked real good. I saw him in San Francisco, and he was looking. He was tanned. He was relaxed.
Ann's 440.
Pardon?
He was at Ann's 440, San Francisco.
No, I saw him at City Lights Bookstore where I was working.
Ah, right, City Lights. Yeah.
And he was great. I said, "Oh, but Lenny, how you doing?"
Yeah.
I know you. I said, "Of course you do." And then so we had a nice chat.
Speaking of nice chats, this is WBAI in New York
City. Oh, who cares?
And
nobody
we are.
Cares. Nobody cares. Nobody's listening.
KWMD. KWMD in Kisilov, Alaska.
Alaska.
Really? And CJLY in Nelson, British Columbia.
Oh, my goodness. How about up there in Sherman Falls, New York, upstate, whatever that is?
Well, they come and join us at 1:30, and it's not Sherman Falls, it's Jeffersonville.
Jeffersonville, Sherman Falls, what the hell?
I'll have you know. And we're also streaming on the World Wide Web at
WBAI.org. You mean to say that if somebody were to type in WBAI New York, they would be able to actually get the voice of your voice?
And if someone were to call 212-209-2900.
My phone number?
They might be able to talk to you. Well, it isn't your phone number.
Oh, my God.
It's our
phone
number.
Did you get my phone number now? What the hell is going to happen to me now?
Well, I could give your phone number.
Why don't
you
give my social security number, too, while you're at it?
I will.
Go ahead. It's 6. I'm very pleased that...
So when you're streaming on the web, does that mean I could go on tomorrow and hear the show?
No.
Well, yes. Yes, it'll be on. The show will be on archive.
On a file.
On an archive for another.
So I could pull it up by putting whatever you put in for the number for the show or something.
Just look for the program that's listed.
This is so modern.
Grid.
So modern.
Radio Unnamable listed in a grid. Well, and it's good for about 2 weeks.
Ah. So I can then copy that file.
Yeah,
and have a recording of it. Because you're not recording this.
Yes, we are. Oh, we are recording it.
Oh.
You got a time check, don't you?
What? A time check?
I don't know what you call it. What is it when you record the show at a very slow speed?
Oh, like the old transmitter going at a fraction of an inch a second in the Empire.
Oh, I see. A log tape. Yeah. No.
No.
I don't think we do that anymore. Maybe we do. I don't know.
I don't know what
I don't
we
know.
Do
There's
anymore.
So much going on in the world that I really... You know, I can't keep up with these the things these fancy electrons are doing, Marshall.
Oh, I do know that Sarah Palin's daughter, Bristol, broke up with Levi.
Yes, she
did.
I
read that today.
I think that's terrible.
Why that? Why do you think
that's
terrible?
Well, because who's going to have custody of the child?
I could give a, and I'm not going to say it.
I'm so concerned.
Really? Okay.
I've been raising stem cell embryos here. I've really? Taken them in.
Just so high off the ground, I've even raising them.
I get Barton. What are you saying? What are you mumbling?
It's all right.
These are my children. I'm looking after them right now, making sure that they stay frozen. I love every one of them.
Do you have names for them?
Yes. Tiny. Shorty. Little guy.
Would you, no.
I can't do Dan Tapioca right now.
Why not?
Oh, I don't know. I guess I have to be coaxed.
Oh, well, you mean not...
But I can promise you sometime we will do Dan Tapioca.
Uh-huh.
Dan Tapioca is the...
New character.
My new character. It's me. It's me doing Dan Tapioca. What is that?
Oh. It's nothing. Forget it. Don't pay any attention.
I thought it was my
Don't
heart.
Don't pay any attention to that.
I thought it was my defibrillator taking off.
What is Dan Tapioca?
Dan Tapioca is a dancer, and he dances. He does the tapioca.
Is it like the lambada?
No, it's close to it. It's
like
a dance craze. That's
is it
like
the karaoke?
Like the karaoke.
Okay.
But it's not a foxtrot or a polka. It's a tapioca.
Is it like flamenco or...
No.
It's like
Xavier Cugat music. Man,
he had
from the
1940s. He squeezed that chihuahua, you know. They had to replace that chihuahua from time to time because he'd squeeze it.
Well, would
you... Remember
if you had a chihuahua, wouldn't you squeeze it too?
Yes, I would.
I'm pretty sure you might think about doing
it. You might even give it a stimulus package.
Well, I'm conducting an orchestra. I don't want to be holding a chihuahua.
No.
And I think that's what Kooky was doing.
Squeezing his chihuahua while he conducted. Well, he was a big freak.
I think he was. He should have had a burrito.
Well, then if he squeezed a burrito...
That's okay.
It would come out all over what's her name?
Abby
Carmen Miranda.
No, Carmen Miranda didn't work with him. I'm sorry.
With Cougar?
No, not Come with Cookie. No.
Oh, of course she did.
You're on the radio. Nope.
I think we're on...
Cookie.
Abby and Charo.
Abby Lincoln, Charo, they would.
You're on the radio.
Abby Lincoln.
Abby Lane.
Oh.
We don't need this guy. Get rid of this cigar store Indian.
Whoops, he's off.
Give him a cigar. I think that's.
I always get through every.
Hey, hey, hey.
Hi there. You're on the radio.
Hey, hey. How does that guy get through every week? Does he just wait around lying in wait?
No, he
lives
there.
Anybody else like that?
He lives at WBAI.
This is Ben. How are you doing, Bob?
All right, Ben. How are you?
Hi, Ben.
Very well. I heard you talking about Lenny. So I'd call in and have nothing to say. No, but I missed the beginning of the show, but I was.
Well, why don't we repeat it for you? You can actually get it by streaming it, and you don't have to miss the beginning of the show. You can actually get the
Marshall.
Whole show by putting it. What?
Calm down.
I'm excited.
Why?
Bob, I'm excited with what the 21st century has given us.
Exactly. Exactly right. Exactly right.
Of course I'm right.
Well, who could doubt it?
Whether you missed any part of the show is not important to us because you can always get the whole show, the parts that you missed.
I am going to do that tomorrow when it's up.
Do it now.
All right.
Do you still have your oxygen tank here?
Yeah, yeah. But I
because
think
Marshall's using up all the oxygen in the room.
Get out of here, Bob.
Noisy.
Mm. Oh, mine. So, Bob, what's new?
Great question.
What's
That's
new?
The question.
Well, some things are coming along, working on this and that.
I saw some really great previews for films that are going to feature you, and I was really, really more than happy to see those, and they look really good.
Oh, you mean the trailer for the Radio Unimble documentary?
Yeah, yeah.
You want to show the trailer?
I can't show it here, but it's on YouTube.
Very good, very good. I was laid off recently about 4 weeks ago.
Oh, I'm sorry.
You still getting a paycheck?
I'm actually waiting for a judgment. Don't want to say too much about it, but I'm sort of in a bit of a gray area as far as the unemployment goes. But I think it's probably, hopefully it's going to go my way. And either way, we'll forge ahead and do what we need to, but I'm only one of many, as you know, and I know a lot of people personally who are getting laid off, and so it's just getting very interesting for all of us, and we do the best we can, but so I guess I sort of wanted to air that. And
what did you used to do?
Well, I was working in development, which means raising the money, in a nonprofit on Wall Street.
You worked with Bernie Madoff?
He was in our database.
Now you're talking.
You bet he was. Yeah, sure he was. Yeah.
I just bought a mouse pad, a Bernie Madoff mouse pad on eBay.
Is that spelled B-U-R-N-I-E?
B-E-R-N-I-E. Bernard L. Madoff, M-A-D-O-F-F.
Uh-huh. No, it's another guy, I guess.
Must have been.
The guy who Madoff.
I mean, if somebody had written that stuff in a novel, everyone would think it was over the top. Oh, come on, they made the guy's name Madoff in the novel? Oh, come on, he Madoff? Oh, please. They'd say it was over the top.
Oh, I know, it's pun time.
I know, well, it's unbelievable. It's like, but, well, cool. Well, I love always hearing anything about Lenny Bruce, and, because I was so interested in him in college, and I guess I don't have all that much to contribute, but I do remember when I was reading
did you hear us?
It's on my mind.
Did you hear us talking about Fred's latest film?
No, let me tell you, maybe just do a quick recap, or...
Yeah. Sure.
Yeah. Sure. What is it?
My latest film is called Asada, a.k.a. Joanne Chesimard, and it's a very brutal story about a wounding on the New Jersey Turnpike of wounding and the killing of a Black Panther and this woman, Asada Shakur.
Oh, yes.
And a highway patrolman also caught some fire and died. And there was a very trumped-up trial. She was convicted of the murder of the patrolman, which is totally impossible for her to have done so. It's like a thin blue line about this particular story. And it follows her to prison, and then she escapes with the help of three young Black Panthers, and eventually emerges in Cuba. And that's
She's got a phenomenal following around the world of young people who read her book and consider her an icon and a great freedom fighter.
Have you sent her a copy of your film?
Oh yeah, absolutely. In fact, I was in Cuba any number of times and talked to her at length on the phone. But she's under a $1 million bounty by the state of New Jersey. So she's not very free with her. She cannot be very free with who she sees and not sees. But I was in the years in developing the film. I went back to see her, but I met her very early on in the '60s, in the '70s, and decided then that I would probably make a film about her, and eventually came around to doing so. So it's opening at the Anthology Film Archives on the 2nd of April for one night as part of a New York Filmmaker Series, which is sort of prestigious in the underground independent film world, the real underground independent film world, meaning films that are made for less than $100,000 or whatever. But that's not the criteria. The criteria is that these films that they choose come from thousands of films, and they're very, very good. So the Anthology of Film Archives is on 2nd Avenue and 2nd Street, 32 2nd Avenue. That's East 2nd Street and 2nd Avenue. It's Friday evening at 8 p.m., and anyone who wants to come and see the film is welcome to come. The tickets are very inexpensive. I don't know the exact price. $7 or $6 or something like that.
Just as well, you don't know the exact price.
Very good.
It's another thing we can't do.
I did bring a trailer. If you want to hear a little bit of it,
but sure.
But you'd have to punch it up. It's one of three things on a DVD. You can hear the soundtrack.
Oh, okay.
So
yeah, last time I was at Anthology Film Archives was to see a couple of films by Robert Downey Sr.
Oh yeah,
I got hip to through Radio Inamable, of course.
Well, I knew Bob Downey Sr. very well. He was part of that activity in the 70s, in the early 70s with
me. I was in the movie Pound.
Oh, were you?
Yeah, I was one of the leads.
Oh, great.
I say great, yes.
Is that a DVD or a CD?
That's DVD.
What?
Yeah, and it's the third, you'll see, it'll come up on the screen. You have to pick.
It says you have to pick the first.
No, it's not the first. The first is of my film Events.
Uh-huh.
You don't want to play that. Well, that's like an hour and a half.
Uh-huh.
But you, I think the soundtrack will work. It's I'm in it. I play Kunstler, the lawyer.
And
that's part of the trailer. You hear a little bit of me doing my acting chops. I got some acting chops in the film as well as writing and directing it and putting it together.
And then
if you're really Lenny Bruce fans, you should get a copy of
Lenny Bruce Without Tears.
Which is really the definitive documentary on Lenny. There's, except for something, a guy ripped me off for 50 minutes of my film, a guy named Robert Weedy, came up with a film about 98, something like that, called whatever it is.
Uh-huh,
there's really,
yeah. Yeah, I've seen them both.
Yeah, there's really no other films that have as much of Lenny in it as my film.
Right.
Certainly not the Dustin Hoffman film, but Bob and I were going over that before about the Dustin Hoffman film.
I have the book, the unauthorized or the biography of Lenny Bruce. It's a big one.
Albert Goldman.
Ladies and gentlemen,
Lenny Bruce.
Yes, thank you. That's exactly what it is. And you know, I was prompted to call because you mentioned his suicide. And you know, I mean, if you've read the book, I'm sure you're aware that he leaves some doubt
as
to the circumstances surrounding that last night. I mean, he says that says that there was a well-established routine that Lenny had of you know, cooking up his medicine, and et cetera, that sort of didn't seem to be happening. It was almost like someone had visited him and fixed him, and then he was out. You know, he just described the
who was the singer, guitar player that wrote If I Were a Carpenter?
Tim Hardin.
Dustin, okay. What's his name again?
Timmy Hardin.
Right. Well, the story I heard, and this was through Maury Hayden, who eventually became Lotus Weinstock, and the story I heard was that Timmy delivered what was some really bad, and he had no idea himself because he hadn't used it yet himself, and it was just some really foul, overpowering heroin, or whatever it was.
Sure.
And Lenny had no idea he was going to fall flat on his face, because he, at that point, was pretty hip about what he was doing.
I don't think it was anywhere near
a suicide.
He wasn't using anything for a long time. Well, when I saw him, that was 3 weeks before he died, and he said he had completely given up on that. He wasn't using that.
If anything, he was using speed.
There is a possibility that.
But the whole idea that somebody did him in or the cops did him in, we looked into that before we committed ourselves in the film to anything about it. And believe me, I'm the first one that's ready to say, hey, the cops did him in, because that's what I do in Assata Shakur. As far as I'm concerned, they did do her up, and there's many reasons to believe that she had absolutely no way that she could have shot this highway patrolman, and that the only way that he was shot was in crossfire from other police that were shooting this at the car. So,
yeah.
But with Lenny, I think it was basically just didn't know what he was putting in his arm. And I don't think he tied up with any idea that he would go over in his face in that bathroom. So that's my feeling. I think the film doesn't really get into it, because my general feeling is that the film is basically about his life in comedy, and not about the annoying details of, or the gossipy details of his death. The fact that he died, you know, he died the way he died, and that's depicted in the film, but the temperature of my film is basically to celebrate his comedy, and so that's what it does. It does that from beginning to end. It's all Lenny. I tried to impose very little over it.
Right on, man. Right on.
Yeah.
Thanks.
So Lenny was a funny man. Not only
penetratingly
funny in terms of bringing up topics that nobody dared. I mean, you have to understand, we were looking at Milton Berle. So you should be looking for on that screen is Assata, a.k.a. Trailer. And then that's what you want to play.
Just tonight, I watched Milk, which I don't know if you've seen Milk.
Yeah, I love Milk. I think Milk...
I felt that film left the door open to certain... I mean, sometimes with these... especially with any kind of important assassination around which there's some, you know, maybe... pretty unbelievable. And if you're, you know, I've done just a little bit of listening to Mae Brussel.
Okay, we're going to try to play the trailer for the...
Okay, let's hear the trailer, and thanks, you guys, and...
thanks for calling.
It's been a lot of fun talking to you. We'll talk to you later. Bye-bye.
Thanks very much for your insight. Here we go. She was hit 3 times in her shoulder, side, and back. She sat there bleeding. And then, they lied about her. They would have you believe that as she lay there, slowly bleeding to death, she miraculously got out of the car, walked over to the fallen trooper, picked up his gun, and shot him twice in the head. They know she never got out of that car. But why was the trooper on the ground in the first place? They had no lie for that one.
That's it. Marshals, remove Mr. Kunstler.
Weren't you thinking it was possible that you might have killed the trooper yourself, wildly firing in all directions, madly firing your gun?
Chesimard was convicted in the killing of Trooper Werner Foster and the wounding of another trooper in a furious shootout on the New Jersey Turnpike.
And she was convicted in a trial that was biased, bogus, constructed, and set up.
You can jail a revolutionary, but you can't jail a revolution.
They want her dead, Asha.
Christine Todd Whitman, when she was the governor, created a $50,000 bounty.
Governor Whitman herself went on TV and put a bounty on her head for $1 million.
Put $1 million bounty out for Asada. What that does is say, we're willing to pay for kidnapping.
Open the doors.
You just decided to kill everybody.
Big, they started shooting again. Big said, he's good and dead now.
Edgar Hoover had already said that Black Panther Party and the likes, they had to be neutralized.
There's danger in the true telling of this story.
I don't even know what's going on.
Don't you realize we're living in a police state?
I have to go to Cuba and meet her face to face.
Well, I'm not going with you, Asha.
You have to.
It's Cuba. My people. It's the reading. It's music.
If we do nothing else in this generation, if we can pull this off, we will rock this world. We have to make a way for Asada to come home.
No doubt about it. A state trooper was murdered, but Asada Shakur did not commit that murder.
If you think you know this story, you should see this film. If you believe the lies about her, then you must see this film.
I'd just like to say that that music is by Roy Hargrove. You better be careful. You're going into another piece of film here. Okay. I was just saying that... Are we on?
Yes.
I was just saying that the music you just heard in that trailer... It's interesting. It sounds like radio. Although it's a trailer, it's a visual trailer, it's not too bad of just hearing the soundtrack. Be interested to know what that sounds like just listening to it on the radio.
Well,
but Roy Hargrove, who's a great young jazz trumpet player, one of the best, wrote the music and performed the music for me. So that I'd like to say that. And in that trailer, you saw Asada Shakur. You also saw Kathleen Cleaver, the wife of Eldridge Cleaver, and you saw me and playing Bill Kunstler, and you also saw Fred Hampton, who was one of the murdered Black Panthers in Chicago.
And Charles Barron.
And Charles Barron, Representative Charles Barron's in there too. Yet, all people who. Propose that we find a way to bring her home without putting her back in jail for this crime she didn't commit. It's a real travesty to force her to be in exile. So, and there's many, many other black liberationists who rose up and said what they had to say in those days, who through one way or the other were attacked or arrested and hounded, and that are in exile right now. And they're like a class of imprisoned people because they can't travel freely and they can't come back to the United States. So that's hopefully what the film might elucidate, enunciate, whatever. I hope.
Never happened before.
Well, it did happen with Thin Blue Line. You know, that film elucidated the possibility that they were wrong, keep this guy locked up and on death row. And they had to look into the aspects of the lying that took place. And then the film itself brought out one of the truth in the other boy who really shot the policeman. Well, what do you mean when you say it? What never happened before?
What I'm saying is
that a film has never done that? Enabled?
No, what I'm saying is that the government has a long and, malignant memory?
Yeah.
It just doesn't forgive. It would say, oh, the law must be observed, especially amongst poor people. You have to put poor people away. The law must be observed. You know, we don't have.
Yeah, but the law was broken here by the lies.
Exactly.
And the injustices.
Exactly.
And there's many, many injustices that have been overturned.
Exactly. Well,
I don't agree with
the DNA evidence. Yes, but this isn't one of those situations.
Well, this if there were an opportunity to adjudicate an appeal without her presence, I'm sure that the appeal could be won. It was a different climate at that time. That was a real climate of fear that the state of New Jersey and the state of New York, look what they did with Attica.
Absolutely.
They shot and killed many, many people up there because they wanted their rights. And the state of New Jersey, and listen, all over. They killed people in Chicago, killed people all over. So the state of anger with black dissident or black disagreement with brutality, which it had every right to be. I mean, it's still going on. You know, in this trailer, you don't see it on the, you couldn't see it, but when you hear those da-da-dum, there's actually something that comes on the screen that says, in the Sean Bell, Amadou Diallo, and the Jenna 6 are indications that Fred Baker's Assata Shakur film is, you know, saying what has to be said, because we still have that. We still have police brutality. We still have black people dying at the hands of police, and the police walk away scot-free.
That's true.
Unfortunately.
Oh, and that is true. And that's a real sad state for our economy.
Yeah,
so,
I love this new man. I think he's elegant. I think we have to all look to him and do what we can to bring things back into shape and with him. I think he probably will do the best he can. But the other part of it is still not over.
Did he ever go on record about Fred Hampton, since it was from in his part of the
Chicago?
World? Yeah.
I don't think he was old enough. Yeah. And I don't know that.
I'm sure Bill Ayers gave him the straight poop.
Yeah. I don't think so. I don't read that from Barack Obama, that he's going to take radical positions, or even enter that arena. I think he's very careful about that.
I agree with you.
I'm not faulting him for that. Listen, we've lived with fancy, brilliant, good fancy people all our lives in American politics. And who've kept a keen eye as to what they could say and what they couldn't say, in terms of how the public would accept or not accept it.
I think he'll pick his battles carefully.
Yeah, exactly. I agree with you.
And I think what I think is really interesting is I feel very strong and very optimistic that we're going to have nationalizations of various industries and various aspects of the economy, because. Just because Obama is not a liberal or not a lefty in a sense, he's a moderate and he's a pragmatist.
Yeah.
And I'm feeling that the automobile industry may have to be nationalized.
Well,
we exported all the jobs.
I mean, my ego would get stroked a lot because I'm an old lefty.
Me
that
too.
Said, you know, that said, this is where it eventually has to go. You know, and I really believe that that's eventually where it had to go, to nationalization of the large industries, to a free basic socialist type system. So what am I going to tell you? Yeah,
alibi.
I think it'll come at the hands of somebody who's pragmatic and is not a lefty.
Well, he seems to be moving in that direction, and that may be the way you have to move. Whether it'll stay in that position or not, if he improves the situation through some form of moderate nationalization, and it gets better, and it can hold to where it doesn't exemplify the greed and the profit motive, and it goes back to private ownership, then of course it's just temporary. We're gonna use the red Band-Aid.
I think the bloody shit myself.
Yeah. Well, speaking but of
bloody
speaking
shirt?
Of the no of greed and the bloody shirt and the red Band-Aid. This is WBAI in New York City.
A for-profit organization.
And we're also being broadcast at this very moment on WJFF in Jefferson, Grahamsville, and Liberty, New York. And we are being heard on KWMD in Kisilov, Alaska, CJLY in Nelson, British Columbia. And on the World Wide Web, we are streaming at this very moment on WBAI.org.
Are we on it in Grover's Corners?
We are, as a matter of fact. We are in Grover's Corners.
That's a thrill.
That's just been revived on Broadway.
Yeah.
Yeah. Nice.
And that's where the Martians came down.
That's true.
To me... It's just America.
Yeah. Then they came to New York for a pastrami sandwich, right?
And they got sick.
The first thing, and they got sick, right?
They couldn't take it.
Yeah. And
I was, let's see. Oh, now the name is slipping me. Who did those Clint Eastwood movies, the spaghetti westerns?
Sergio Leone.
Well, Sergio Leone and his guys came to New York.
They ate more pastrami than...
They doubled up. They couldn't take it.
They couldn't take it.
You're on the air. Hi.
Hey, how's it going, guys?
All right.
I just wanted to call in. The conversation has drifted off Lenny a bit, but... I had a copy of Without Tears for years, and I'm glad I got to listen to one of my favorite shows, and actually thank you, Fred.
Okay, listen, hey, that makes me so warm all over.
Really fantastic.
Yeah.
I did a memorial show at the West Beth in 96 on anniversary for Lenny's death, and we did all
the stuff.
We mixed it with I was part of a sketch comedy group at that time called Third Rail, and we alternated back and forth, but we built the night around him. And the one thing, it's funny when I'm listening to guys, because I'm just in my 40s, early 40s, yourself and Marshall there, and one of the guys who came down, unfortunately I can't remember his name, and I don't want to turn on the lights and wake my wife up and look at me.
Don't do that.
But, he produced the Lenny Bruce show at the Carnegie Hall. Trying to think of his name, but he was down there that night. And the thing about it is that the people who knew him, every time I talk to somebody, the warm feelings, just like you guys were describing, and the funny stories, you know?
Yeah. Listen, it's very interesting that you've called and talked about your show at Westbeth. There's a guy I just recently saw do Lenny at the the Public Theater. What's the name of the club there? The
Joe's
Pub, yeah. And his name is Steve Quifo. And he's just brilliant.
Yeah.
He just incorporated himself into the... He's channeling Lenny. Phenomenally brilliant at it. And then a guy who died, unfortunately, Bernie Travis, who starred in a multimedia I did on Lenny way back at the Village Gate with Art DeLugoff, produced it with me down at the Village Gate.
And it was a multimedia. And actually, I went heads up against the Lenny on Broadway because I had this show. They were going to do it, and then they went with O. Horgan and what's his name, Paul Barry, Julian Barry script. But the comedian who basically was also at that time trying to put Lenny out, and he then played Lenny in my play, the multimedia that I did down there, was Bernie Travis. And so I just wanted to pay some respects to Bernie because he was a great supporter and comic.
Yeah, we had a guy who did Lenny's work. Of course, his name's escaping me now. So you believe it? It's only not that long ago. But
Steve.
It might have been, but
Steve Quifo.
He would have been only in his early 30s.
Yeah, that's what he is.
Yeah,
he's about
34, 35
years
old. He really does maybe very, very well. Yeah,
phenomenal. Yeah. I was absolutely floored when he invited me to come and see his show because he said that he used my film, such as the story I told before about Dustin, who used it for 2 or 3 years and then had the damn nerve to tell me, well, it's not a very good film, you know. Anyway, that's Dustin.
Yeah,
but I didn't think Dustin came anywhere near Lenny.
Right.
Like, for instance, I'm an actor. I come out of Broadway acting, and for a long, long time before I got into films. And I went out on the road. I'm emphysematic. Right now I'm on oxygen. It's like a thing. And in my nose. But before this happened, I was able to handle the 7 hours of Angels in America doing Roy Cohn, which was a nemesis of mine because I used to be on a picket line when I was like 5, 7, 8 years old. I was on a picket line against what he did to kill the Rosenbergs. Okay. But the channeling of a human being that you can either hate him or love him, whatever, is a real craft, and you see it in Langella and Frank Langella in Nixon doing it. Nixon, I mean, there's a real involvement and craft in being able to do that, and I did that with Roy Cohn. I knew Roy Cohn. I hated his guts.
Yeah.
I didn't say it.
No, you didn't.
No. It sounded like I said it, right?
No.
But okay.
You left
no doubt about it.
No doubt about what
right.
You wanted to say.
And, but Dustin came nowhere near near Lenny.
He was doing
a little bit better than, you know, 789, 99, 89, 32.
Huge disappointment because
he was very disappointed.
I'm a fan of Bob Fosse's work too, but that was a disappointment.
I don't think Bob Fosse knew Lenny.
Right. Yeah.
One scene Dustin did in the movie. It's the scene on the bathroom floor, in my film is with Nat Hentoff.
Yeah.
And it's the scene about where he's saying, "Well, Dirty Lenny said a dirty word," and
he's playing the piano.
And he's playing the piano.
Yeah. What a heartbreaking scene.
Yeah. And he took that because it was the only sort of kind of physical thing that he took, and he really nailed it. Dustin nailed it. That one scene, just using that dialogue, not doing what Lenny did. Which was very heartbreaking because he was very overweight and he was very stoned out of his burden and knew something was going to go wrong in terms of his life at that point.
I noticed high as he was too, he was still
he was brilliant.
He was still conscious about his weight there, you know.
Yeah.
It was a real
they put the weight on. That weight went on real fast when he did that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm an actor as well and it's funny when you said that about Cohn, because when you play these characters that are, you know, spiritually repulsive or whatever, just repulsive in general, you know, I just came across a Marx quote, which I think every actor should know. Do you ever hear that when Marx...
Carl or Groucho?
Oh, Carl, actually. Yeah, no, and he wrote, nothing human is alien to me.
That was Socrates.
Yeah, I saw it in the Marx Reader. That's why I put.
Socrates said that, and Tully Kupferberg said everything human is alien.
And, yeah, right.
I thought Dick Cheney said that, right?
And you pick up the check.
Yeah, but I won't keep you guys. I put that on my calendar. By the way, Film Archives is one of the finest places in New York.
Oh, it's unbelievable.
Everybody should support it.
And I'm going to see Rip Torn and Coming Apart Sunday. I can't wait to see that picture. And this was a picture that competed with my film to some degree. Moses Ginsberg was I always forget his whole name. Was Milton Moses Ginsberg. I love that. Milton Moses Ginsberg. And but he made a film with Rip Torn and Sally Kirkland called Coming Apart. And that's showing this Sunday. And Rip Torn's going to be there, and Moses Ginsberg is going to be there, and I know them both.
I've worked with his daughter, Angelica, but and Angelica. But anyway, I'll see you there, and thanks again for making the great films, and thanks for everything, guys.
Okay, come
best.
To see Asada.
You'll
be very intrigued with that.
I'll be there.
Thank you. Bye. You're on the air. Hello. Hello.
Hello.
Hey. Hi. Good morning.
Hey, Bobby, how you guys doing out there?
Okay.
Oh, all right. You're calling from Lake Michigan.
I am. Hey, beautiful show and beautiful people talking about beautiful things.
Very good looking.
So, Lenny Bruce, man, my father knew him.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Wow.
My father was a vaudevillian, okay? And he knew Lenny's mom, I guess.
Sally.
Yeah, I guess so.
Sally Maher, yeah.
And my father was an MC, and he was an entertainer, you know.
Yeah.
He was all over the vaudeville. And, early 50s TV, actually.
Beautiful.
So, and he told me a story. He said, I taught Lenny Bruce how to walk on stage. He was giving a little acting coaches, I guess, you know.
Right.
So anyway, yeah. That's when I got exposed to Lenny Bruce. Bob knows my father. We had an antique toy shop on Second Avenue.
Right.
Really? You know, my father. This is Fred, a baker, and my father Harry Baker. If you know Second Avenue, we opened that deli.
Which one? The little one on the corner?
No, Second Avenue Deli. We opened it. My mom.
Oh, downtown.
Yeah, on 10th Street.
Wow.
Yeah, we opened that, and it is in its infancy, and then the guy who's heralded his brothers have run it. I was just saying is very interesting that scene down. I thought you meant downtown on Second Avenue.
No, up on 62nd. It was called Fun Antiques.
Oh yeah.
And then we had the big circus sign in the window for like 40 years, something like that.
Right. I think I remember. I think I know that. Although I'm a,
yeah, so
I'm a
my father was Chick. My father was Chick Darrow. So.
Chick what?
Darrow.
I think I knew him.
He used to do. Oh, probably did. He used to do the balloons.
Ah.
He invented the balloon act, basically. I got pictures of him making balloons in 1930.
Oh, beautiful, beautiful.
He was doing the animals and stuff.
Yeah.
But anyway, yeah, that was Chick Darrow. But yeah, and Lenny Bruce, man. I just found a Lenny album. Horrible name, The Sick Humor of Lenny Bruce.
Well, Phil Spector. Phil Spector was basically producing Lenny Bruce albums in those days.
Saul Zance.
Oh, that's what that is?
Saul Zance.
Fantasy Records.
Fantasy Records is Saul Zance.
Saul's Dance?
Zance. Z-A.
Oh, it was Zance.
Yeah, Saul Zance.
But it was originally Phil Spector.
Oh.
Yeah. Early on, Phil Spector. In fact, is if you see Lenny Bruce Without Tears, if you look at it, you'll see Phil... When the camera starts moving in, just at the end, and I'm playing Lenny's death theme, or by Tom Finn, beautiful, beautiful melody that Tom Finn wrote. He wrote Walk Away Renee, and he wrote some music for that film for me. If you go in closely, you'll see Phil Spector standing, documentary shot of him standing at Lenny Bruce's gate when they discovered his body, and the cameras took shots of all the celebrities who came up the hill to see what happened, because there was all this noise up at the top of the hill where Lenny's house was. All the cops were going up there, et cetera, et cetera. So the footage that could that I found, KTLA TV, this is so many years ago, had Phil Spector. It had I can't remember his name. He was in westerns. He was like a real old Hollywood actor. He probably lived next door, and you know, it was sort of interesting stuff. And then of course they bring the body out, and it's pretty heavy to watch.
Yeah. What's the name of your film, sir? I'm sorry.
Film?
Yeah, your film about Lenny?
Lenny Bruce, Without Tears. Without Tears. And it's gettable in basically every video store there is, because it's handled by First Run Features, and they sell it broadly. You know, I mean, any video store you go in, they may not have a copy.
Is it on Netflix?
It's on Netflix as well. Yes, you can do it through Netflix.
That's awesome.
Yeah, and I'm trying to get Assata Shakur get going like that.
That would be sweet.
Yeah, that'd be nice.
Wow, what a sad, crazy, totalitarianistic, fascistic business planet we have now.
Yeah,
kind of really fragging annoying.
Yeah,
it's like, well, we can't have socialism, but we can have fascism.
Yeah, oh, that
not good. Fascism bad.
Well, that's like
socialism
Lenny.
Better.
That's like Lenny's thing, right? Was if the titty's pretty, no, we better watch out. but if the titty is bloody and maimed in Vietnam, that's cool. You can put that right on. Yeah, we want to see that. You know.
If it bleeds, it leads. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like we got to have sweaty, sexy bodies, but sex has got to be bad. So it's taboo, so people really want it more.
Yeah.
So then we play with them again, and we'll tell them, you know, oh, look, a couple of black guys shot somebody. Oh, no, you know, but they can blow up entire continents.
Yeah.
Just, like, destroy at will, like a bunch of leeches. No, leeches that are termites or something. They're trying to turn the world into sawdust and a pile of gold. Uh-huh. And it don't make any fragging sense.
Never
did. Me batty.
Sounds like that should be part of your song.
Yeah, well, probably is, right? By the way. I'm Bob, can I read another stanza?
Sure.
Thank you. All right. This is Georgia Darrow Saves the World. No. These are the words to save the world. And the song to save the world. If I could, I would. I'd find the words. If I can create the lyrics, tether the verses to the heart of human kind, speak in the tongues of angels and man, and gorillas and lions to add to that. So the blind of spirit, the blind of heart, the blind of conscience, the love blind, the radical, the zealot, the committed, the hateful, the possessed, the depressed, the political animals, the political thieves, let's do it that way, the honest, the foolish, the educated, the uneducated, the evil, the good, the atheists, the deists, the mothers, the fathers, the techies, the trekkies, the geniuses, the trekkers, the young, the old, the religious, the irreligious, the hopeful, the hopeless, the vegans, the omnivores, the bankers, the bureaucrats, farmers, mechanics, engineers, oh, when the saints go marching in song, with lyrics to save us, no rules, no bull, chaos. Chaos. Chaos is the natural state of affairs. Why don't we just, you know, chaos is the natural state of being universally. Natural state. Chaos is peace.
Chaos is peace. Chaos is our friend in the sky. And my son says, when I said the skies, he says, he laughs and declares, he's heard the word skies. There's only one sky, he says. Share the space. Share the stars. Share the money. Share the honey. Tickle my funny bone, honey. Lyrics to make love by. Make love, not war. Some of the words to save the world. Amen.
I was around when she
think it's my name. But what's passing you is the nature of my game. When I saw that it was a time for change, get these songs, ministers, at the station, scream the names. Road and tank, and the channel's red, and the bill stays raised, and the body stank. Please submit you. Hope it gets my name. But what was in you is the nature of my name. I watch it bleed while the kings and queens of the penalty case by the godly list. I shouted out, who killed the Kennedy? You and me. Let me please introduce myself. I'm a man of wealth and days. I need tracks for the truth. Who can give me thoughts they think to my face? Pleased to meet you. Hope you get some. Buzzing you is the nature of my game. Just as every cop is a criminal, and all the sinners are saints. His head is now just call me Lucifer, cause I'm in need of some restraint. Come on, T.T., get it off the air.
King's execution, 4 years after, remember how those courtiers took their final bow. String up every aristocrat, out with the priests and let them live on their fat. 4 years after we started fighting, Mara keeps on with his writing. 4 years after the Bastille fell, he still recalls the old battle yell. Down with all of the ruling class, throw all the generals out. Why do they have the gold? Why do they have the power? Why? Do they have the friends at the top? Why do they have the jobs at the top? We've got nothing, always had nothing, nothing but holes, and millions of them living in holes, dying in holes, holes in our bellies and holes in our clothes. Mara, he fought and he fought unafraid, sniffing down traitors by traitors betrayed. Marat in the courtroom, Marat underground, sometimes the otter and sometimes the hound, fighting all the gentry and fighting every priest, the businessman, the bourgeois, the military beast. Marat always ready to stifle every scheme of the sons of the ass-licking, dying regime. We've got new generals, our leaders are new. They sit and they argue, and all that they do is sell their own colleagues and ride upon their backs, or jail them, or break them, or give them all the axe. Screaming in language that no one understands of the rights that we grabbed with our own bleeding hands when we wiped out the bosses and stormed through the wall of the prison they told us would outlast us all.
Marat.
you down. The bloodhounds are sniffing all over the town. Just yesterday, your printing press was smashed. Now they're asking your home address. Poor old Marat, in you we trust. You work till your eyes turn as red as rust. But while you write, they're on your track. The boots mount the staircase, the door's thrown back. Poor old Marat, in you we trust. You work till your eyes turn as red as rust. Poor old Marat, we trust in you.
And you're listening to WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored WBAI, to KWMD in Kasilof, Alaska, CJLY in Nelson, British Columbia, and WJFF in Jeffersonville, Liberty, and Grahamsville, New York. And we're also being heard on the World Wide Web at WBAI.org. You want to call us, we are at 209-2900. And we're talking at the moment to actor, filmmaker, jazz singer, Fred Baker.
Yeah.
And
I've been singing ever since I was a kid. That's the whole entree into show business is... Why don't you sing good? Why don't you get up and sing? And you're 4 or 5. You know, you don't even know that you're singing. You just sing because you heard it. You heard it on the radio or whatever. And you start singing. And they keep putting you up to sing because they like you singing, you know. So I've been singing all my life. And now I study, have been, since my wife died in 83. In 84, 85, I met a man in this town called Barry Harris, who's a bot. Piano player, played with Charlie Parker, played with McCoy Tyner. He's played with all the brilliant jazz musicians going way, way back. Barry's 83 years old. And Barry is one of the great humanitarian teacher musicians. And he teaches for next to nothing. And on Tuesday nights in New York, about 60 or 70 singers will show up for a three-hour workshop, vocal workshop, and about 40 or 50 instrumentalists will come after that. He's now doing it in The Hague and in Rome. He goes all around the world. He's world famous for keeping the flames of jazz education going. And he sponsors young players. So I'd just like to say over the radio, hello, Barry. You're so wonderful. He's such a wonderful, wonderful musician.
You're on the air.
Hello. Who's that?
This guy has been calling for months and months and months, singing these pseudo-Indian chants. It's like some kind of obsession he has. I don't know whether he's trying to make it rain or whether he's just one of the Schmohawks.
The Schmohawk. The
You're on the air.
Wait a minute. I wanted to sing along with him. All you needed was a rhythm section.
You're on the air. Good morning. Good morning.
Good morning. Lenny Bruce did one of the funniest animated cartoons I have ever seen.
Thank you, Maskman.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah, well,
yes. What do you want Tonto for?
I want that Indian over there.
I want to commit a natural act. You want to do what?
Yeah, I want that Indian over there.
I want to commit a natural act.
Ma, you hear what he said?
Yeah, I hear what you said.
Ma, you hear what he said? He said he wants it. Yeah, great.
Hysterical.
That was made by a guy named John Magnuson. Or at least he was the producer, owner of that film.
Didn't Lenny write it?
Well, he wrote the routine. It was consistently part of his act. I mean, that and Father Flotsky and all the other Religions Incorporated and Jewish and Goyish and all the different parts of his act. That was one of the winners.
I don't know Jewish Goyish.
Well, I'll tell you if you get your goddamn hands off me.
Oh,
and that's the Lone Ranger voice.
Yes.
Well, I'll tell you if you get your goddamn hands off me. You know, once upon a time. Yeah, it was funny routine.
When Gene Hackman did the.
I don't know if homosexuals feel it's a funny routine, but.
Oh.
I mean, taking advantage of that as being a you know, but how else are you going to make humor but take advantage of certain things that
other people... He was speaking the truth.
Yeah, yeah.
When he said, I like what they do with faggots, they stick them in prison with a whole lot of men. Very clever.
Yeah.
He's speaking the truth, like he always did.
Yeah.
And I'm damn near pissing my pants. I was laughing so hard. There's only one other time that I can actually remember that I've come close. That was when I was watching Young Frankenstein, and Gene Hackman did that little bit with the blind hermit. He spilled soup on the monster's lap, Peter Boyle's lap.
Uh-huh.
I damn near pissed on myself. I was laughing so hard.
I wanted to ask Marshall. He had told me he was going to see Enter Laughing in the new production.
Enter Laughing?
Yeah.
Wasn't that with Sandy Dennis?
Way
back then? Is Marshall still with us?
I think so.
Is he?
Marshall?
Hello? No, I guess not.
Guess he went bye-bye.
Could be.
So anyway, that's all I wanted to say.
Well, thank you.
One of the funniest little... And it's only like 6 or 7 minutes, and it's packed with so much truth.
Mm. Yeah.
It's great. That's all I wanted to say.
Well, thanks for calling.
And
supporting Lenny, the idea of Lenny.
Oh, always, man. I saw Lenny Bruce Without Tears when it came out.
Great.
And it's far better than that other documentary, which really...
Well, he ripped off that guy, that town hall thing.
Yeah.
That guy ripped off 50 minutes of my documentary to make his documentary. So it's not even really a documentary. It's just a grab job. Unfortunately, that's the truth. And I'm saying it in public, so if he wants to sue me for libel, he can.
And it's really, the second half of that movie is really about Lenny's legal problems.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's all hawkinish about family and what his wife didn't think or thought, and what his barber thought about Sally. I mean, it wasn't, you had to concentrate. I just felt, and this was the fight between myself and the Broadway show, the Julian Barry, Tom O'Horgan, Lenny on stage that led to the Bob Fosse film with Dustin Hoffman.
I never saw it.
And it was just too much soap opera. And that's what they... I had a stage piece. It was called Linear Multimedia that I did after I started putting the elements of the film together. And I lost out in terms of who had more power. They just... The Broadway company had more power. I was more like an off-Broadway company. So, I think when you get someone as brilliant and as multi elements, the elements that he dealt with in society were so myriad that why worry about that he had family problems or that he was a little unfaithful on his wife, who was a stripper. The point of the matter was is that that wasn't the important thing about Lenny, but so many people, even in the business, they think that's going to catch the fire in autobiographical work. They think the only way you're going to catch the fire is if you get off that stuff that most people didn't understand, and you get onto his dirty underwear stories and how his mother taught him that, told him not to do it in the bedroom because they had to wash the sheets. It was, you know, it didn't make any sense to tell that kind of story about Lenny Bruce, to tell his personal dirty laundry stories. And
his mom was bringing Lenny to a talent show when he was a kid, like the 10 Mac, I believe.
Yeah, and yeah, he did the 10 Mac, and he won it, and he won Arthur Godfrey. He was very, very funny, but he used to do mimicry. I mean, he did, you know, the German accent. He did the gay guy. You know, he did all the Milton Berle shtick very early on as a young kid, as a 16, 17-year-old comic.
I've heard some of that. It's very funny.
It is very funny because he had an ear like a hawk. I mean, he heard what came out of him in let's say Father Flotsky, where he did Irish, Brooklyn, I mean, all in a row, and right on the nose, so that he brought you into the corniness of that kind of B-movie with Barry Fitzgerald, you know, but don't say that Dutch. You know, he's just a very funny guy, man. Yeah.
You mean, that's right, jiu-jitsu.
Yeah. And we want the vibrators.
Get him, Dutch. You're not kidding.
I'll see you later.
Okay,
take care.
You're on the air. You are on the air.
Hello? Hello?
Hello?
Hi. It looked like Albany didn't go this week, the train fare, stuff like that.
Huh?
No, I'm saying it looked like Albany didn't go through this time with the train fare. You know, they supposed to have it was money for the MTA.
Were we talking about this?
No, I just want to make a small comment about that, you know.
Well, you made it. You're on the air.
Hello?
Yes.
It's all from the Bronx here. Hello?
Yes, hello.
Yes. Sounds like the Bronx.
Right, okay. I'd like to say that you mentioned jazz before.
Yeah.
In every section of this country, jazz was brewed to the local taste years ago. How popular is it today?
Oh, it's very popular all over the world.
No, I'm just talking about the U.S.
You mean
It was brewed to the taste of people all over this country at one time. There's many different types of jazz.
You mean commercially popular?
Well, no. Well, in other words, just in liking jazz.
Mm-hmm.
How popular is jazz throughout the whole U.S. today?
How do you gauge that? I don't understand.
Well, no, I see that.
You tell me. I mean, how do you gauge how popular? How do you answer?
Well, I don't know. In other words, I don't hear anybody talk about it.
Well, it's a very eclectic taste, jazz. Jazz is really a classical form of popular music. It's what almost all of what you hear in popular music derives from.
Right, but
I mean, go figure why people don't consistently want to go back to the almost classical roots, which are the chords and the chord changes, the things that jazz are constructed on. So they go for the more popular forms of it, which in this day and age are very far afield.
Well, everybody knows the New Orleans jazz, but then in other parts of this country, there's types of jazz that doesn't sound like New Orleans jazz. It's derivations of that. According to what I'd seen years ago, was people that were talking about jazz on the old TV9 talk show that used to be in the daytime.
Well,
I recall that they didn't even remember the name of that program, but now, but it used to be on the daytime. It was an old talk show.
Well, you know, I hope I'm not offending anybody, but an awful lot of jazz, to me, is I'm drunk and I'm lonely.
That's good.
Yeah. Well, anyway, they used to be going up to Minnesota and stuff. They had their own variety of it, too, and it didn't sound like New Orleans.
No, well, because you had guys like Hoagie Carmichael up there and Johnny Mercer. Mm. You know, it's hard to define jazz per se because there was so much in pop music that then married the blues and married the basic blues that came out of the South to make essentially the jazz book, what everybody in jazz plays, is really a popular songbook done in jazz style.
You're on the air.
Hi, what a great show.
Oh, yeah.
What a great, great show. First thing, I quickly want to say I'm so glad you mentioned Barry Harris. Because I remember I used to see, I'm actually going to be 56 in a couple of days, but I remember I used to see Barry Harris 20, 30 years ago
yeah.
in the clubs. And I hadn't heard of that anything about him. So, you know, being the age that he is, I just automatically figured he's dead.
No. Barry's hardly dead. Barry just did 3 workshops in Rome this week after 2 workshops in The Hague in Holland and is coming back, and I'll be sitting in his class learning a song to sing with 60 other singers next Tuesday. He'll be back to go back to his Tuesday night schedule here in New York. If you want to dig Barry Harris, come to his workshop. It's very, very inexpensive. It's $250. No, write it down. $250. Okay. $250 West 65th Street, Tuesday night. Are you an instrumentalist or a vocalist?
No, to be honest with you, I'm just...
You're a buff.
I'm a buff. I play trumpet. Like, you know, of course, when you go to school, I play trumpet.
Come to the vocal class and then sit through into the instrumental class, and you'll see Barry at work.
So that's 250 West 65th.
250.
Like 250.
Right. West 65th Street.
Like what apartment? Or
there's no apartment. It's a community center. Just walk in. You might have to pay an entrance fee of $7 or $10.
Oh, that's no problem.
But it's like 3 or 4 hours of Barry holding forth with New Yorkers who love to sing.
Go ahead.
Sorry.
No. I'm sorry I interrupted you.
No. That was it.
Okay. So it's Tuesday. What time?
Tuesday. 8 o'clock is a vocal workshop. And 10 o'clock is the instrumental workshop.
I would love to just come and to, like, you know, say good. Hello to him and thank him for, like,
absolutely,
you know,
please. Oh, he'd love it. He'd love it.
Does he still play, like, jazz in the clubs?
Absolutely. He was just at the Village Vanguard for a 3-night stay. He was just at the Jazz Gallery. He plays very often. If you watch the jazz advertisements in both the New York Times, the New Yorker, or the Village Voice, you'll see his name come up. His trio, he plays with good players. I can't recall the name right now.
I'm gonna do that. Also, you mentioned Lenny Bruce.
Yeah.
And I love Lenny Bruce from the get go, like I was 10 years old, 9 years old, because my parents loved Lenny Bruce.
Well, your parents probably my age.
Well, my father died in September. He was 90.
Uh huh.
Okay, so they used to see him all the time. So my father told me there was this one time in which they went to this club and it was pouring. It was Tim and Fenosha, and it was just pouring. And I think it was someplace in Greenwich Village, but you know wherever it was. And they go in there and the place is empty. Except, like, there was this one person there that my father knew, because this DJ, he was a famous DJ in New York, William B. Williams.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so they go there, and there he is, and my father knew his brother very well in the Army. So, of course, they sit with him, and, like, you know how, like, you're in a club, and you almost feel guilty, because, like, for the person on stage, because, like, the place is so empty?
Oh.
Well, it was something like that, and it was pouring. But Lenny Bruce, of course, just did his whole routine, and he was just hilarious, you know, like he always is.
Yeah.
So, of course, afterwards, you know, they go with William B. William, introduces him to Lenny Bruce.
Right.
And, you know, that was like a big thing. So I'm in high school, and it's either like, I mean, either in 10th or 11th grade, and my high school is really pretty good. Actually, at that time, there were more kids who went to Ivy League schools from my high school than any school in the country. But I don't know how the administration got away with it, but they stopped doing regular school on Wednesdays. Regular school on Monday, Tuesdays, regular schools on Thursday and Fridays. And on Wednesdays, it was like called mini school day. And like, it was great because like if you missed a lot of classes or anything, you could have individual attention with the teacher, and, you know, and, or you weren't doing well. But you had to have like three different classes. And they took from the students and, you know, they did a form, they took from the students and teachers courses to teach. And I taught a course with two other my friends on Lenny Bruce. And it was so much fun. And, you know, and of course the next year, there was no mini school day. It was like back to 5 days a week because, like, you know, so many kids cut and parents wouldn't put up with it.
Right.
But that's the story, and I'll let everybody else talk. And I'm sorry. Your first name is your last name is Baker. Your first name is
Fred
Baker.
Fred.
You're not related to Chet Baker, are you?
No, I'm not. I'm not. I love Chet
Funny,
Baker.
Funny, somebody else said that.
I love Chet Baker, but and I love his records. I have tons of them. I love Chet Baker.
To be honest with you, I fell asleep like because I was really tired, and I fell asleep. And then my good friend called me up and asked me, I said, "Am I listening?" And I thought he was calling me up at 6 a.m. Anyways, so but early on you mentioned this. Film this project you did on Lenny Bruce?
Yeah, I made a film called Lenny Bruce Without Tears. It was released in 1972, would you believe?
Can you get that on
Oh yeah, absolutely. You can get it on Netflix. You can buy it in any video store. Just if they don't have a copy, ask them to order it. That will be
You can get anything on the internet nowadays.
Yeah, or you can go to my website.
Oh, what's your website?
filmsbyfredbaker.com. Films with an S.
Are you working on any films now?
Yes, I've just released, in the process now of releasing a film called Asata, a.k.a. Joanne Chesimar, and it's a documentary.
Oh, yeah, that
film.
Much I heard. That much I was listening to that, and it was right after that I fell asleep.
Yeah.
Do you have...
Well, it's a good thing you didn't fall asleep while I was...
No, no, do you have distribution rights for DVD?
I'm the distributor, so you can go to my website, filmsbyfredbaker.com, and we can communicate.
How is this a feature-length documentary?
Yeah, they're all feature-length. I don't make shorts anymore.
You wouldn't want to give out, like, an email address, would you?
Yeah, why not? admin@filmsbyfredbaker.com.
Could you spell that beginning?
Admin, A-D-M-I-N, like administration, except it's A-D-M-I-N, @filmsbyfredbaker.com.
I will definitely be making you, like, tomorrow.
Okay, great.
Thank you very much. It's been a great, great show.
Well, good. I'm glad you enjoyed it.
And also Marshall Efron, you know, he's always really
good.
Hey,
Marshall Efron is big time. Big time actor. Love him.
You're on the air. Good morning.
Hello and good morning.
Hi, how you doing, man?
Good. Hi, I just want to say, as soon as I get a chance, I will be checking out your website.
Cool.
Because I'm very interested in the film, a.k.a. Joanna Chesimard.
Well, I'm glad you are, because that's what I'm doing now. Lenny Bruce I did a long time ago.
Okay.
So I've been interested in her ever since I met her. And I met her in the system, if you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
So I got very friendly with her, and felt that she was treated extremely badly. And I promised, I didn't promise her directly, but I promised myself that I would do her story, and I've done it. I'm very proud of it. Very proud of the piece.
I'm glad you have. You know, a lot of people, you know, were treated badly back then and still are. And you mentioned how you still have things like John Bell, Amadou Diallo.
Genesis, yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I don't expect any magic has taken place with respect to racism in the society. And I think we all have to try and keep a straight head about the fact that no magic tricks have taken place and it's gone. Forget about it. The angers are still there. We have to fight them. We have to go up against them. We have to show them up for what they are. You know, and I'm just very strong about that. Have been all my life. I was on picket lines as a kid against Jim Crow, because of my family and my upbringing, and so that's why I'm very proud of this film about Asada, and I'm glad you reacted to it, man.
Yeah, and that is good to hear. And also thanks for your show, Bob, as well as the having him on. And also, it is a good thing that you're making the point. And you say you gotta still fight it. That is true, because the thing is, you mentioned how these police killings are still going on. And what bothers me is how these things, like a Sean Bell, Amadou Diallo, Sherman Azu, etc., are justified. But then, you look at the flip side, you see...
Oh, they're not justified. They're just shameful and accepted still. That's the hell of it.
That's
not justified. They're just shameful things that this society has learned to accept because of color.
Yes.
That's all it is.
That's
and
true.
It has to stop. And I think we're making some progress with the beauty of and elegance of our president and our first lady. I think we're making some progress of trying to get that mindset out of the white mindset. That, you know, and if we can make any progress, thank God.
And
that's the way I feel about it.
Yeah, but here, and like you said, now the flip side is, now if what happens to unarmed men being shot by police are tolerable because, you know, you were in fear of your life, how then do you explain actual criminals, and I'm not saying they're criminals specifically because they're white, but instance, white criminals, like there was a guy in Staten Island last week, busted with 80 guns, all illegal. Now, how does he not take one police bullet or a huge monster like Scott Siegel, who was in that movie, The Wrestler, actually committing a crime, rams police with his car, doesn't get shot. Now, how is this not life-threatening, but some unarmed guy is? You see, and that's the thing we have to deal with. But while Obama's good, it is really up to his Attorney General, Eric Holder, to really start getting at this. Don't just make a speech on how America's a nation of cowards when it comes to race. Now is the opportunity to at least do something. I mean, you can't do everything, but make a start. So that some of this stuff doesn't continue, because a lot of it is malicious prosecution also. You know, not just bad policing.
Well, I agree with you. I agree. We have to make consistently keep at that, because that's really, really the rotten, some of the rotten core of of the brilliance of America. There is a rotten core somewhere, and that's one of them, and it has to be taken out. It has to be. It's a cancer, and it has yet to have been excised. So we have to keep diligent about it. We have to keep
and those of us just have to make sure that the people that are in power do
the right
what
thing.
They're supposed to do.
That's right.
You know, and like I said, I can't wait.
I agree with you.
Check out your film, a.k.a. John Chessman, as well as your other thing. I thank you all.
Okay.
Lost all sensation. Your friends have sold out. The vows that they took are the secrets you doubt. Your dreams have collapsed from exhaustion and brow.
We'll do a song then about revolution. Song of what's been true of all revolutions from the beginning, the French, the American. This is a fictional song, a cinematic song. You've got a picture, this mansion on the top of a hill housing the last of the idle rich, the last of the bourgeois, the last of the folk singers. As they're being encircled tighter and tighter by the ringing of revolution, all the people on the inside spiritually resemble Charles Lawton. And all the people on the outside physically resemble Lee Marvin. As a matter of fact, the song is so cinematic that it's been made into a movie. It stars Senator Carl Hayden as Ho Chi Minh. Frank Sinatra plays Fidel Castro. Ronald Reagan plays George Murphy. John Wayne plays Lyndon Johnson. And Lyndon Johnson plays God. I play Bobby Dylan. The young Bobby Dylan. In a building of gold with riches untold lived the families in which the country was founded. And the merchants of Star with their vain velvet smiles were there, for they also were hounded. And the soft middle class crowded into the last, for the building was fully surrounded. And the noise outside was the ringing of revolution. Sadly they stared and sank in their chairs and searched for comforting notion. And the rich silver walls looked ready to fall as they shook in doubtful devotion. The ice cubes would clink as they freshened their drinks, wet their minds in bitter emotion. And they talked about the ringing of revolution. We were hardly aware of the hardships they bared for our times taken with treasure. Oh, life was a game and work was a shame and pain was prevented by pleasure. The world cold and gray was so far away in distance only money could measure. But their thoughts were broken by the ringing of revolution. And the clouds filled the room in darkening doom as the crooked smoke rings were rising. How long will it take? How can we escape? Someone asked, but no one's advising. And the quivering floor responds to the roar in a shake no longer surprising. As closer and closer comes the ringing of revolution. So softly they moan, please leave us alone, as back and forth they are pacing. And they cover their ears and try not to hear with pillows of silk their embracing. The crackling crowd is laughing out loud, peeking in at the target they're chasing. Now trembling inside the ringing of revolution. With compromised sway, we gave it half away when we saw that rebellion was a-growing. Now everything's lost as they kneel by the cross where the blood of Christ is still flowing. Too late for their sorrow, they've reached their tomorrow and reaped the seed they were sowing. Now harvested by the ringing of revolution. In tattered tuxedos, they face the new heroes and crawled about in confusion. And they sheepishly grinned, for their memories were dim of the decades of dark execution. Hollow hands raised, they stood there amazed in the shattering of their illusions as the windows were smashed by the ringing of revolution. Down on our knees, we're begging you, please. We're sorry for the way you were driven. There's no need to taunt, just take what you want, and we'll make amends if we're living. But away from the ground, the flames told the town that only the dead are forgiven. As they vanished inside the ringing of revolution.
Lost all sensation. Your friends have sold out. The vows that they took are the secrets you doubt. Your dreams have collapsed from exhaustion and frown. Thank you. as you go to your death on a beautiful day. All the way down, even this shall pass, as we escape in the old part of town, free at last, at last, at last.
Marching down the street, the rolling of the drums and the trampling of the feet, general salutes and the mothers waving we. Here comes the big parade. Don't be afraid, price is paid. One more parade. So young, so strong, so ready for the war, so willing to go and die upon a foreign shore. All march together, everybody looks the same, so there is no one you can blame. Don't be ashamed, light the flame, one more parade. Listen for the sound and listen for the noise, listen for the thunder of the marching boys. A few years ago their guns were only toys. Here comes the big parade. Don't be afraid, price is paid, one more parade. So young, so strong, so ready for the war, so willing to go and die upon a foreign shore. All march together, everybody looks the same, so there is no one you can blame. Don't be ashamed, light the flame, one more parade. Medals on their coats and guns in their hands, trained to kill as they're trained to stand. 10,000 ears need only one command. Here comes the big parade. Don't be afraid, price is paid, one more parade. So young, so strong, so ready for the war, so willing to go and die upon a foreign shore. All march together, everybody looks the same, so there's no one you can blame. Don't be ashamed, light the flame, one more parade. Cold hard stares on faces so proud, kisses from the girls and cheers from the crowd. And the widows from the last war crying to their shrouds. Here comes the big parade. Don't be afraid, price is paid. Don't be ashamed, war's a game. World in flames, so start the parade. In the state of Mississippi, many years ago, a boy of 14 years got a taste of Southern law. He saw his friend a-hanging, his color was his crime, and the blood upon his jacket put a brand upon his mind.
Too many martyrs and too many deaths. Too many lies, too many empty words were said. Too many times for too many angry men. Oh, let it never be again. His name was Medgar Evers, and he walked his road alone, like Emmett Till and thousands more whose names we'll never know. They tried to burn his home and they beat him to the ground, but deep inside they both knew what it took to bring him down. Too many martyrs and too many deaths. Too many lies, too many empty words were said. Too many times for too many angry men. Oh, let it never be again. The killer waited by his home, hidden by the night, as Evers stepped out from his car into the rifle sight. He slowly squeezed the trigger, the bullet left his side. It struck the heart of every man when Evers fell and died. Too many martyrs and too many deaths. Too many lies, too many empty words were said. Too many times for too many angry men. Oh, let it never be again. And they laid him in his grave while the bugle sounded clear. Laid him in his grave when the victory was near. While we waited for the future, for freedom through the land, the country gained a killer and the country lost a man. Too many martyrs and too many deaths. Too many lies, too many empty words were said. Too many times for too many angry men. Oh, let it never be again. Oh, let it never be again.
City rain, I don't know if it's making me dirtier or clean. Went for the subway, but there was no train. And the tunnel was a crumbling for repairs again. And the sign said, "Welcome to America, Jerusalem." Well, I've been around. You could spend forever looking for a friend in this town. And all you get to do is lay your dollar down. Till you're stumbling drunk up the stairs again. And the sign says, "Welcome to America, Jerusalem." In the temples of American Jerusalem, they buy an ounce of South African gold. They don't care who was bought or sold, or who died to mine it. In the temples of American Jerusalem, they buy an ounce of Marseille white. Somewhere on a street with no light, somebody dies trying it.
and somewhere in a crowd, looking the kind of way that makes you turn around, will be somebody who knows what it's about. And she's gone, you take the ribbons from her hair again, and welcome you to American Jerusalem. Live their deaths out on the corner. The pretty people say there should have been a warning, but nobody heard it. Then shadows lick the sun. The streets are paved with footsteps on the run. Somebody must have got double, 'cause I got none. Oh, I forgot to collect my share again. So go west to breathe the cleansing air again. Go Niagara for your honeymoon again. Go on the road if you're gonna sing your tune again. Go to sea to learn to be a man again. Till you come on home to American Jerusalem.
In the state of Mississippi, many years ago, a boy of 14 years got a taste of Southern law. He saw his friend a-hanging, his color was his crime, and the blood upon his jacket put a brand upon his mind. Too many martyrs and too many deaths, too many lies, too many empty words were said. Too many times for too many angry men. Oh, let it never be again. His name was Medgar Evers, and he walked his road alone, like Emmett Till and thousands more whose names we'll never know. They tried to burn his home and they beat him to the ground, but deep inside they both knew what it took to bring him down. Too many martyrs and too many deaths, too many lies, too many empty words were said. Too many times for too many angry men. Oh, let it never be again. The killer waited by his home, hidden by the night, as Evers stepped out from his car into the rifle sight. He slowly squeezed the trigger, the bullet left his side. It struck the heart of every man when Evers fell and died. Too many martyrs and too many deaths. Too many lies, too many empty words were said. Too many times for too many angry men. Oh, let it never be again. And they laid him in his grave while the bugle sounded clear. Laid him in his grave when the victory was near. While we waited for the future, for freedom through the land, the country gained a killer and the country lost a man. Too many martyrs and too many deaths. Too many lies, too many empty words were said. Too many times for too many angry men. Oh, let it never be again. Oh, let it never be again.
Lights going on while the sun's going down. down the rain fell. Strike in the streets, scattered pell-mell. I dream of the clamor of all the church bells, casting iron and brass at J.T. McTell. Casting iron and brass at J.T. McTell. Bell.
Well, are we back on the air? Well, you know, I think it's been, you know, people have said it was a program that they enjoyed listening to. So we almost have to provide, you know, a kind of an antidote that goes along with it. So you're on the air.
Wait. Listen, Bob. Bob.
I'm here, Monroe.
Okay, listen, everyone. I want to protest that I don't think that Bob Fast's program should end in 2 weeks on the archives, because it's usually a very
I agree with you, Monroe, but it's not. There's nothing. Monroe, can you listen for a moment?
Sure, I can.
Okay, there's this is the way.
I've been listening all night.
This is the way they interpret the intellectual property law as it applies to playing performances on the air.
Yeah, you know, music. I know what you're saying, Bob.
Yeah.
But I said it a long time ago, and I want to say it again. I think the station is hurting itself, and you are being hurt, and so on. Now, here's my idea that I said a long time ago, and I happen to have a bad reputation in the sense that people say, well, if Monroe thought that, let's forget it. Now, here's the story. I respect Bob Dylan. I respect Phil Oakes. You know, I respect all the people that you play and have live and so forth. But I say this to you, just as you have previews of coming attractions, when a program has gone past, let's say, 2 weeks, it could be edited in such a way that it still suggests the conversations, like Carl's conversation and Tom from the Bronx and your guest tonight.
You don't know the name of my guest tonight, Monroe?
Well, I know you were talking about
You see, you don't listen, Monroe. That's the big problem I have with you. You're not a good listener.
You have
things to say. Sometimes some of them make sense.
Bob,
but Monroe, you're not a good listener. You know, Fred Baker has been here tonight, for crying out loud. One of the greatest political filmmakers, Fred Baker.
Yeah, Fred Baker, yeah. I've heard the jazz conversation, and Chet Baker was mentioned.
Chet Baker tonight. Who cares?
Monroe,
I mean, I love Chet Baker, but
Monroe,
I'm Fred Baker.
Yeah, Fred.
Monroe, a system that only has an output.
Listen, it produces a very weak signal.
But if you allowed some feedback, Monroe, and you incorporated some of the things that people other than you say into your gestalt, you might get a better reception.
You're giving me a bad rap. You know what I mean?
Well,
yeah,
Monroe,
look, I'm saying something positive. I'm saying have your program on full tilt for 2 weeks. But then Bill Propp or somebody else who's sympathetic with your work could hello.
Well, you just created a class with practically no one in it, Monroe. So,
to, instead of being a 2-hour, 3-hour thing, it would be shorter, but it still would preserve a certain historicity, if I may. Hello? Oh, Bob.
You can't say historicity and then expect to have
people... I thought
people...
he said hysterectomy.
I'm trying to come through. Look, I'm trying to be helpful. It hurts when your program isn't maintained for 90 days in some form. It's like the previews for the movie. Hello? Hello?
Why are you saying hello?
Because you're not responding or agreeing with me.
I definitely raised an eyebrow, Monroe.
Fred Baker, are you still there?
Yes, I am, Monroe.
I say this to you. I love Bob, and for some reason, and I know the reason, it's because I'm a critical listener. I forgot your name. I didn't think I'd have to bring it forth at this moment.
Oh, it's okay.
Well, Monroe, do you remember the name of some of his films?
No, I don't, and I didn't.
Well, now why is that? You cannot have been listening. You weren't listening. You were so intent on preparing what you had to say, what Monroe's vision was, that you didn't hear about Joanne Chesimard. You didn't hear about Lenny Bruce. See, right now you're talking, Monroe, and you know you have to listen once in a while, Monroe. I think it might be wise for you to enter a religious order.
Yeah,
you know, if you became a Trappist monk, Monroe, you might make some advantage, you might improve your
Bob, will you?
Okay, so you suggest we should move on and go on to another call.
Give me more, Al.
You're on the radio.
Hi, Bob. This is for your guest. It's funny, I was talking to my wife about Thank You, Masked Man, yesterday, and there's a synchronicity of it, and you brought it up before. Is that available on DVD?
I think it is.
Yeah, I have to look again because
I'm trying to figure out who has it. I'm not absolutely sure that First Run Features. Try him, John Magnuson. Just Google John Magnuson, Magnuson.
The way it sounds, yeah, that's what I was going to.
And I'm sure you'll get a lead as to who handles it.
Okay, and then thank you so much. And then the second thing about you mentioned Chet Baker. And
I'm not mentioning Chet Baker at all tonight. I'm trying to concentrate on myself over here.
I'm sorry. Well,
no, that's all right. I'm sorry. I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding with you.
No, but the whole Lenny Bruce thing, I mean, you know.
There's definitely a similarity. I was very interested in the documentary they made on his life, or what you could call a life. You know, he was just a brilliant musician without really... I don't want to say anything, but there was something very sad about Chet's life.
There is a kind of deterioration, so
obvious, you know.
Exactly, that's kind of similar.
Yeah,
thing. But what I wanted to say just about musicianship, and you know, in the classical world with the violin, a person that leaves me cold is Joshua Bell, even though he gets all the gigs. Okay, but this fiddle player, but. A person that also leaves me cold compared to Chet Baker. Chet can play like a few lines, and that says volumes. And this guy, Chris Botti, just leaves me cold, man.
Me too. I absolutely agree with you.
Okay, do you?
I did. Yeah, I just watched him last night,
and
it's almost like what's that guy, Kenny G, a little bit on the trumpet.
It's the Kenny G of the.
It's the Kenny G of the trumpet, with a little more hipsterism thrown in. the move of the body, the move of the arms. But it's Kenny G on the trumpet, and that used to make me give up my lunch, Kenny
yeah,
G,
exactly.
You know.
But that's the thing, and that's what passes for, quote, jazz. The only thing that supports Chris Botti is that he has, you know, some really good sidemen.
Unbelievable. That guitar player will play for forever.
Right. I mean...
And his drummer's very good. Yeah, well, yeah.
That's it. And they
they're very, very lightly featured. I mean, you can't fault him.
No.
Because he's a big star, there's a reason for it. He's extremely attractive. He plays very, very listenable jazz, which,
correct.
Of course, is an oxymoron.
That's the problem, right?
Yeah.
Exactly. Well, thank you. I just wanted to have that conversation.
Yeah, cool.
And I will check out the Joanne Chesimard film.
Did you know of... I keep saying this. Nobody even remembers. Tony Fuscella? Tony Fuscelli.
Go ahead.
Tony Fuscelli was a trumpet player of the late 50s, early 60s, died in the mid-60s. Died in his youth, but he had something phenomenal, and there are a few recordings on him. Fuscelli. Fuscelli.
Okay, I'll check him out.
Or Fuscella, maybe Fuscella with an A instead of an I.
Okay.
Yeah, but if you're into trumpet players, that's one of my favorite.
I am. I like people like Blue Mitchell and, you know.
Oh, yeah. Blue Mitchell, I dig it.
Yeah, right?
Blue Mitchell was on The Rat Race, a G.G. Grice score done for my first prize-winning short dance film called Jazz Dance Number 1. It was with Donald McHale and people from the Martha Graham studio, and G.G. Grice wrote the original piece written up in a book on G.G. Grice called Rat Race.
Right.
And Blue Mitchell was a trumpet player on that date, way, way back, I hate to tell you when, 63.
Right. Yeah.
I made that film. So yeah, Blue Mitchell's number one trumpet.
There you go.
Yeah.
Well,
okay.
No, thank you.
Thank you, man.
Okay.
Right.
Thank you all of the callers with minor exceptions, and thank you very much, Fred Baker.
Thank you, Bob.
I had a good time.
You know, this
morning.
Is the second time I'm on your show. The other time is Baba Yutzka's site, and I hate to speak Yiddish at this point of the night, but that's all I can do. But I was on your show, I don't know, it's got to be 40 years ago. So you're doing this an awful long time. You really know what you're doing. I think you're one of the greatest at this, because I've never been so relaxed in my life.
Yeah,
and I've had a great time. I've had a great time. I hope I did okay.
You did great.
Okay, great. Fabulous.
You did great.
Here, here.
And in just a few minutes, Ibrahim Gonzalez, who came in for a moment and then left again, will be here with In the Moment.
Ah.
So get set for some great radio.
Okay.
Forget me not, and for second
you to my breast, I would believe that east was west, would believe
what an atrocity. Really, we really ought to have some better equipment around this place. That's Jack Hardy singing one of his most... Jack. Well, anyway, we've had a good time here this morning, despite the fact that the equipment is less than... despite the fact that the equipment is falling apart. Fred, you want to say a final word or two to... Jack. Sorry, Jack.
Your silk song.
Sorry, Jack. I'm sorry, Jack.
Did you want me to say something?
Well...
I guess the best thing for me to say, since I'm a... You know, I do have a film called Asada, a.k.a. Joanne Chesimard, that is going to be shown at the Anthology Film Archives Thursday, April 2nd. And you can get further information by reaching my website at www.filmsbyfredbaker.com. So come and see my films or send me an email. All the contact information is on that website. Thanks very much. I enjoyed the night talking with Bob.
Oh, and I enjoyed the night talking to Fred.
I don't know if it's making me dirtier or clean. Went for the subway, but there was no train. And the tunnel was a-crumbling for repairs again. And the sign